Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
She's pure alligator. Pure white.
Two.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
One.
Albino
affairs.
Officer David Causey of the UNT Police Department still can't stop thinking about it.
There's a little bit of excitement.
About a week ago, he was involved in a high-speed chase.
And when I started getting closer, he started moving, so then I had to move a little bit.
Officer Causey pursued his man on foot before cornering him in the landscaping.
Right over here.
Unfortunately, he got away. But not before Officer Causey snapped this picture of the runaway rodent.
I definitely wanted a chance to be able to get that picture.
Lucky the albino squirrel is UNT royalty. Seeing him is usually quite rare, even now, during Squirrel Awareness Month. Yes, October really is Squirrel Awareness Month. But for some reason, Lucky has been showing his face a lot more lately.
Whenever somebody sees Lucky, there's a crowd quickly forms.
A lot of people just really enjoy when they see Lucky. People stop.
He's an unofficial mascot.
He might as well be official. I mean, over the years, there have been a lot more albino squirrels on campus than eagles. Not to mention, students love the little guy. They gave him the name Lucky because they say he brings just that, luck.
It's kind of a tall tale around campus. If you see this little squirrel, then you're going to have a pretty good semester going for you.
Of course, when I tried looking, I wasn't blessed with the same good fortune. But just when I thought my luck had run out, Lucky ran out. This special squirrel treated me to a quick appearance before disappearing into the nearest tree.
I was fortunate enough to see Lucky, but not everyone can be so lucky.
Squirrel! Let's go get it. Go get it. Let's get it.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we're still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we're still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we're still singing for St. Louis.
Series pulled me over and lied about what he heard. Just wanted to see. You know, I didn't have any license plate, but I did have papers. Where do you get this car? I want it. You want it? Yeah. How'd you do that? And I said, well, I won it in the World Series. And he looked and he puzzled. He said, you're... I said, that's right. He said, could I have? I said, no. You can't have anything. If you're through with me, I gotta go.
I'm Sarah Fenske. This is St. Louis on the Air. Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson died Friday at the age of 84. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch was the first to have the story, reporting that Gibson died under hospice care in Omaha. He had been battling pancreatic cancer for more than a year. Less than a month ago, Gibson's longtime teammate, Cardinals great Lou Brock, also died. Gibson's honors are many. He was a two-time World Series champion in 1964 and 1967. A two-time Cy Young Award winner, a National League MVP, a nine-time All-Star, and much more. He ranks first among Cardinals pitchers in wins, games started, complete games, shutouts, innings pitched, strikeouts, and ERA. We had the chance to talk with Bob Gibson on this show in 2015. He'd just come out with a new book, Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game. It told the story of the first game of the 1968 World Series against the Detroit Tigers, when Gibson struck out 17 batters. We first asked Gibson why he chose to focus on that first game of a series that the Cardinals ultimately lost in Game 7.
The World Series is probably the most important time of anybody's career, not just that year, but anybody's career. And that's what you aim for at the beginning of the season, to get into the World Series. And to have that and pitched one of the best games of your entire career at the time when it was the most important. I thought it was just nice to tell that story. The strikeouts weren't that important to me at the time. I think probably it's a little nicer now than it was then. But that's not what you really aim for. What you aim for is to win the ball game. And I was about to win the ball game. That was a little more important. And I always liked to pitch. I didn't like to waste a lot of time. And when Tim came running out behind home plate, I had to stop. And that was driving me crazy. Let's go. Let's go. Let's get it over with.
Tim, of course, is Cardinals catcher Tim McCarver. They were paired for nearly 200 games and became close friends.
Well, McCarver started out as a problem as far as the race was concerned. Mm-hmm. And to see him go from who he was to who he became was just wonderful. And not just him, though. You know, I did a lot of growing up myself. Mm-hmm. Because I was ready to, I was very combative. And when I thought that somebody was not treating me well, you know, we might have a fight on your hand. And he turned out to be a wonderful individual. I adore him.
President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, just a few years before that season. Discrimination remained rampant. And when we talked to Gibson in 2015, only a few months had passed since a Ferguson police officer shot and killed Michael Brown. Gibson said he didn't have a full grasp of that incident. He did address discrimination and police behavior more broadly.
I have yet to figure out how the police can get away with some of the stuff they do and just saying it was in the line of duty. I remember once, and it wasn't like Ferguson, but I like to drive a motorhome. That's what I do. August Bush gave me a motorhome when I retired. Mm-hmm. And I was driving through California with Gene Gieselman and his girlfriend and me and my girlfriend, and there was a cop just following us. He got behind the motorhome. He just followed us. And after about 10 minutes or so, he pulled me over, and I got out and asked him what was wrong. He says, I noticed that you only have one license plate, and it's on the back, it's not on the front. I said, well, I'm from Nebraska, and it doesn't require two, it's just one. On the front, I had a license plate that had two Cardinals on it. And I thought, why is this guy stopping me? Why is he stopping me? And the only thing I could come up with was harassment, period. It will happen. I've had several things. When I won the MVP of the World Series in 1964, and that was before they had the interstates finish here, I was driving to Omaha, and I was going through one of those little small towns in Missouri. A guy pulled me over and said that he had a report that somebody had stolen a car just like that. The Corvette that they gave me for winning the MVP of the World Series, pulled me over and lied about what he heard. Just wanted to see. You know, I didn't have any license plate, but I did have papers. And where do you get this car? I won it. You won it? Yeah. How'd you do that? And I said, well, I won it in the World Series. And then he looked and he puzzled. He said, you're... I said, that's right. He said, could I have? I said, no, you can't have anything. If you're through with me, I got to go. But see, those kinds of things happen. It still happens. And so, but I don't know. Sometimes some of the guys do some things to cause some problems. And I say some of the guys, some black people do things to cause problems with the police. Some don't. I would imagine the majority don't. But to see it happen is not surprising.
Bob Gibson was enshrined in Baseball's Hall of Fame in 1981. He joined us on this show in 2015. St. Louis Cardinals owner and CEO Bill DeWitt Jr. said of Gibson's death, quote, Bob Gibson was arguably one of the best athletes and among the fiercest competitors to ever play the game of baseball. Even during the time of his recent illness, Bob remained a strong supporter of the team and remained in contact with members of the organization and several of our players. He will be sorely missed. Pitcher Bob Gibson died Friday. He was 84.
Chris Stevenson, Bucks.com.
George, you've been active in all areas when it comes to issues of social injustice. Obviously, it's hurting you right now and it's affecting you. What do you feel like you or you all can do from Orlando, from the position that you're in right now?
I mean, we can't do anything. First of all, we shouldn't even came to this damn place, to be honest. I think coming here just took all the focal points off of what the issues are. But we're here, so it is what it is. You know, we can't do anything from right here, but I think definitely when this all settles, you know, some things need to be done. I think this world has to change. I think our police department has to change. Us as society has to change. And right now we're not seeing any of that. You know, lives are being taken, you know, as we speak day in and day out, and there's no consequence or accountability for it. And that's what has to change.
Sports has a TV ratings problem. In recent big events, from horse racing to hockey to golf to basketball, numbers are down, sometimes to historic lows, which is surprising because during the shutdowns of the pandemic, many fans said they were desperate for their return. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
It's 2020, so, of course, the downturn in ratings for sports on TV has become political.
Welcome to the NBA bubble.
Let's go!
The NBA in particular, with its steadfast commitment to social justice issues, prompted a Twitter spat this week. Republican Senator Ted Cruz said the NBA's historically low ratings in the current finals were because every game was a left-wing political lecture. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban fired back, paraphrasing here, poppycock. TV ratings watchers acknowledge sports and politics are doing some ratings damage.
Are there a handful of people who will follow what Trump is saying with regards to the politics of the NBA and as well as the NFL? Yes.
Tom Umstead works for Multi-Channel News, a cable TV trade newspaper.
But I don't think that has an overall effect on the numbers.
Other factors that might? Viewers turning to actual politics on news programs as next month's election approaches. The games with few or no fans and fake crowd noise taking away from the usual excitement. A major culprit, though, seems to be a September-October confluence of sports caused by pandemic restarts that all happened around the same time.
Almost too many men on the ice there on Tampa. Skylar Johnson jumped on the ice.
And deals. And this one is lined down the right field line towards the corner. Screen coming from Russell. Five to shoot. Nice five. Bird to Russell and Wilson with the eraser rejection.
We have a glut of it now all at the same time. So it's sort of like, what do I watch now?
That's Mark Berman. He started the website Programming Insider, where he writes about TV and media. He says the glut of sports helps explain the dip in everything from the NBA to hockey's Stanley Cup Finals and their lowest numbers in 13 years to golf's U.S. Open and its 55% plummet from last year's ratings. All of those events are normally played in June. Last week, sports writer Jason Lloyd tried to reverse the ratings trend single-handedly.
Set the alarm, got up early in the morning, made some coffee, and sat down and watched the French Open.
And so began 20 hours of TV chaos. That's what he titled his article in The Athletic about watching tennis, baseball, and basketball nonstop.
It was a fun day.
Lloyd illustrated the mashup of sports that has both overwhelmed and thrilled fans. He thinks things will get back to normal, somewhat, when sports return to their usual seasons and fans once again fill the stands. But Lloyd also says the current ratings dip shouldn't be explained away just by the pandemic.
With cord cutting now and with people moving away from traditional television and the younger generation is just watching the highlights and not necessarily the games. I think all of this contributes, and that part is not changing.
But neither is the appetite for live sports. Tom Umstead of Multi-Channel News says the proof is the multi-billion-dollar bidding for those sports from networks and streaming services, which he predicts will continue, despite the doom and gloom about ratings. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Money, 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 money. Yeah, I kind of like the sound of it.
Chase Bank is planning to increase home lending to African American and Latino families in Chicago to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. The bank wants to address some big inequities revealed by WBEZ this past summer. Here to tell us more is our Linda Lutton. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Mary.
Can you give us an overview of what Chase is planning to do?
Well, Chase says it's going to help more Black and Latino families in Chicago become homeowners. The bank says it wants to give out about 3,000 additional loans above what it would normally do and increase lending by $600 million over the next 5 years. The effort is part of a $30 billion nationwide commitment Chase announced just yesterday to address the racial wealth gap. Homeownership is very tied to wealth in the U.S. Chicago was the only city where the bank is making a specific commitment.
This comes on the heels of an investigation by WBEZ and City Bureau. You looked at home mortgage lending here, and what you found was an eye-opener.
Yeah, we found very deep disparities in how much investment flows to Chicago's white, Black, and Latino neighborhoods through banks' mortgage loans. Chase Bank, in our analysis, had the deepest racial disparities of all major lenders. The bank did 80% of its home purchase lending in Chicago's majority white neighborhoods, but only around 5% in Latino neighborhoods and just 2% in Black neighborhoods. So that degree of disparity was shocking.
Activists picked up on this reporting. The Chicago activist Jamal Green took to protesting outside Chase Bank branches. Did that play any role here?
That's definitely right. Green has been demanding Chase give the Black community $1 billion in reparations. And yeah, his protests have led to the temporary closure of dozens of Chase branches. And Chase is acknowledging activism's role in bringing about this change. I talked with Sarita Battles. She's the head of affordable lending at Chase nationally.
I think Jamal and the city of Chicago brought some things to our attention. And I'm glad that they held us accountable to some of those things. It was necessary for us to pay strict and close attention to the work that we were doing in the Chicago market.
Chase was also talking to Chicago community groups. They helped inform sort of the nuts and bolts of this plan. The bank is hiring community home lending advisors. Those people will be on staff at branches on the south and west sides and will really walk people through the home loan process. Chase also says it's expanding grants to homeowners and it's touting a loan that requires a very small down payment.
What are the activists saying about Chase Bank's plans?
Well, I did check in with Jamal Green. He calls this a step in the right direction.
Thankfully, Chase is starting to listen. But these are drops in the bucket for them. Hopefully, they'll start to be proactive about really doing what they should be doing in neighborhoods of color all throughout the country and changing their racist lending practices.
$600 million, that number sounds huge. Is it?
Well, that depends on how you look at it. $600 million is pretty huge, but it is spread out over 5 years. And remember, just 2% of Chase's home purchase lending went to Black neighborhoods. So that's a small number. And when you double a small number, you still have a small number relatively. Even so, the bank says this is not going to be easy. It's going to have to make a real effort it hasn't made in the past to get to these new lending targets and to get many more Black and Latino families into homes of their own.
That's Linda Lutton, Chicago Neighborhoods Reporter here at WBEZ. Thank you, Linda.
Thanks, Mary.
If white people chose to stop spraying the chemtrails or doing aerial chemical dumpings, that we would most likely solve this entire global pandemic of the what they're calling the coronavirus, because the sunlight, a certain temperature, certain weather, it can't survive in a certain temperature. And if there wasn't chemtrails, then the temperature would increase. Well, then white people stopped spraying chemtrails so much. They still were spraying, but the very next day, I didn't see very many chemtrails in the sky. It was warmer for 2 weeks.
This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour. The coronavirus has killed 200,000 and infected 6.5 million people in the U.S. But amid those statistics, there are the 2.5 million Americans who have recovered from the disease.
We're survivors. I thank God for it, and that's all I can say.
We hear from three of those survivors about what it was like to have COVID-19, why getting better is an ongoing process, and why it affects people so differently.
Your personal experience is so vastly different than mine, than to yours, than to anyone else's.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
As we've been reporting, the president is telling Americans not to be afraid of coronavirus, while the death toll in the U.S. tops 210,000. Cases are climbing again in much of the country, but attitudes about the threat vary greatly. Our Amna Nawaz explores why so many Americans think fears about the virus are overblown.
It's become the story of two pandemics. Even as the virus surges in multiple states, hundreds of Americans die every day, and the U.S. leads the world in infections and deaths, millions of Americans don't see the virus as a threat. Why? To try to understand, we spoke today to Bruce Penuel.
Things are different.
A 68-year-old retired police officer from Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And in Chattanooga, to 57-year-old Pam O'Neill.
I am a former nurse, and I'm from Tennessee.
Also to 41-year-old Adul Ali, a small business owner.
I live in a little town called Kannapolis, North Carolina.
All Republicans planning to vote for President Trump, none believe the virus is as bad as experts warn. We asked them all if they know anyone who's been sick or died from COVID.
By the grace of God, I haven't had any family members to get sick because of COVID. I do have some friends that have had family members that have been sick.
No, I do not know anyone who's had COVID or has passed away from COVID.
I don't know personally of anyone who has died from it. I do believe the pandemic has been overblown, that we're taking too many cautions and changing our lives too drastically.
We asked how much the pandemic impacts their day-to-day lives.
I don't think my day-to-day life being retired has been affected greatly by it. You know, often I'm outside, obviously, and I'm not wearing a mask outside, but I'm not afraid to talk to people. You know, I'm not hiding.
From a business perspective, you know, at the beginning it was really tough, but now, you know, as things are starting to open back up, we're recovering a little bit more.
I do wear my mask when I go out because it is mandated. I think there's a lot of good information for those who are going to look for it, to, you know, take a look at it, to let you know that this is survivable.
We asked how worried they are that they or someone in their community will get sick.
We don't know a lot about it. So I don't know exactly how I'm going to get it.
Chances are, if you catch it, no, and you're in reasonably good health, that you'll be okay. So, you know, I haven't been worried about getting it.
So I feel very confident that since I don't have any pre-existing underlying health issues, that I would not only survive COVID, but I may be one of those lucky ones that might actually be asymptomatic.
First of all, these are people who don't necessarily feel the immediacy of this.
Lee Meringhoff is the director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion, home of the Marist poll.
When you're talking about Americans who do not see the virus as a threat, who are you talking about?
They are people who tend to be in more rural areas where the, you know, the virus has not been as much as pronounced. But they tend to be people who are part of the president's base. They tend to be male. They tend to be people who are not likely to have a college education. The folks who are supporting Trump, that group, that core group, are the ones who are most likely to follow him on this issue.
The partisan divide is clear in the latest PBS NewsHour Marist NPR poll, showing while 76% of Republicans trust the president's pandemic message, only 5% of Democrats do. But Meringhoff says regardless of what they're experiencing now, Americans are mostly on the same page about what's ahead.
A majority of Americans think that this is not going to end anytime soon, that there isn't a light at the end of the tunnel. So what we're seeing is a lot of people who think we're in for the long haul, despite what the president says.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
Actually, in this country, we get very little reporting, really, about about how corona is affecting the African continent. What is it, how is corona actually reported on the African continent in America? You know, what is there anything reported about corona on that continent, or is it zero?
For several months, confirmed coronavirus cases in Africa have been falling. The continent seems to be bucking the global trend. One of the countries getting international praise for the way it's handling the disease is Senegal. Despite having a fragile healthcare system, the West African nation has managed to largely contain the pandemic. Mayeni Jones looks at how they've done it.
It's Friday prayers at Masaliku Jinan, West Africa's largest mosque. As worshippers file in, a worker sprays their hands with sanitizer. Inside, most people are wearing a mask. In the era of COVID-19, some places of worship have been hotspots for the disease, but not here. There have only been 15,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Senegal and around 300 deaths.
Africa was actually reached by the disease a little bit later, so it gave us also opportunity to take experience on the other people.
According to Amadou Sall, the director of the Institut Pasteur in Dakar, the country's experience with previous outbreaks, including Zika, dengue and Ebola, has proven beneficial.
Yeah, I think the experience of Senegal dealing with as a disease has been key to its current success. Has the structure, the ecosystem built for the disease has been actually reused and readapted for COVID.
If somebody catches COVID-19, what happens?
Someone from the Minister of Health, from the health district level, would come, arrange for him to be samples, and that sample is sent to us, and we have this objective that each sample that's come into the lab should be out within the day, and less than 8 hours everything should be out.
Rapid testing is the cornerstone of the country's containment strategy. Back in February, before the coronavirus had even reached Senegal, the Institut Pasteur was one of just two labs on the continent that could test for it.
Air mustn't get out from this room.
Indongo Dia is in charge of the Institute's testing lab.
At the beginning of the pandemic, let's say in early March, we were able to test between 300 and 500 samples. And today, we are able to test 2,000 samples a day.
The Institute says it's also decentralized testing, by opening labs outside of Dakar to ensure rapid results. Within the coming weeks, it plans to roll out an antibody home testing kit. This will show whether someone has had the coronavirus in the past and will cost just over a dollar, with results in 10 minutes. Raising awareness of the disease has united musicians and decision makers. A global index by Foreign Policy magazine gave the country the highest possible score for its communication strategy. Whether it's through murals at the University of Dakar, in music, or in the country's mosques where imams have been encouraging people to wear masks, the messaging is clear. It seems to be working. Only 26 patients are currently on ventilators in the entire country. It's a long way off from the initial fears of doctors here, worried the disease would challenge the country's already fragile healthcare system.
We were worried because we don't have many materials. We had just one center, and in this center we have just 12 beds for all Senegalese.
Dr. Kadiata Diallo is the coordinator at the Treatment Center for Epidemics of the Fan Hospital.
In this bed we don't have any oxygen, and we don't have many materials to treat the case. We were very worried and very afraid.
Now Senegal is keen to maintain the progress made so far, but there are signs people and businesses are relaxing. At the height of the pandemic, temperature checks were widespread, but they're less common now. However, with 4 million people expected to attend the Grand Magal of Touba, a religious pilgrimage this week, authorities here will have to remain vigilant if they want to avoid a surge.
Mayeni Jones reporting.
North Carolina A&T State University is the largest historically black college in the country. With 12,000 students, it's an average size for the UNC system. But as Liz Schlemmer reports, it has one of the lowest rates of COVID-19 spread among public universities in the state.
Brenda Caldwell is the student body president at North Carolina A&T. She has some ideas about why the school is, so far, managing the pandemic well.
I think HBCUs in general have a more familial culture. So I think when it comes to COVID, we are wanting to keep each other safe and keep our community safe, especially since we know that this disease affects Black and brown people more.
Caldwell's parents also attended A&T. Her grandfather was the band director and her grandmother taught here. She wears a sweatshirt that says Aggie Bread and a blue and gold face mask and sits in her student government office decorated in the same school colors. She knows that a number of North Carolina HBCUs have lower than average COVID-19 case counts. NC A&T has had 63 student cases and no clusters so far.
A lot of our students are first generation students. A lot of us are appreciative of the opportunity to even be in college in the first place. And so I think a lot of students, especially freshmen, they don't want to mess this up.
The university has taken all the standard precautions. They reduced dorm capacity by about a quarter, signed up a third of students for all online classes, put signs up to promote social distancing, passed out masks, and set up testing regimes. When the university reopened in August, the Student Health Center tested about 2,000 students. This week, they're making a push to test every student as flu season sets in.
So if you're taking at least one class on campus or that you're coming to campus, as far as the faculty and staff, then we are testing them.
That's Dr. Yolanda Nicholson, the Director of Health Education and Wellness at the Campus Health Center. The federal government recently distributed rapid response COVID-19 tests to HBCUs. Nicholson says NCA&T's fresh stock of 9,000 tests has made this new testing initiative possible.
Well, I think it could have been done. We may have had to do it over a longer amount of time, whereas now we have everything and we can go right forward at full-fledged.
The UNC system does not have a standardized way for reporting COVID-19 data, but a WUNC analysis indicates that A&T has tested more per student than many of the other system schools. That analysis also found that a UNC system student who attends an HBCU is less than half as likely to test and record positive for COVID-19 than a student who attends a non-HBCU. Caldwell, the student body president, says it helps that students are taking their responsibility seriously. She's been tested 5 times this school year.
My friends and I, we get tested regularly. Like, we all send screenshots of our negative tests just in case, like, if we do gather, we know we're being safe and we still wear our mask and we still social distance.
A&T also produced a social media video to encourage testing.
This is the beat, y'all, of the year!
In the video, students dance with cotton swabs in their hands, and several of them are wearing their Greek letters to represent their fraternity or sorority. Leah Tyson is the president of the A&T chapter of the historically Black sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha. She says testing numbers on campus shot up after that video went out.
I think people really do look up to us, and even though we are more than, you know, those sorority or fraternity letters that we wear, it's important for them to see us in that light and to see that we know it's our responsibility, you know, to keep us here on campus and to keep us safe.
Tyson also thinks they've got one more thing, motivating students to be extra careful.
I really, really, truly do believe that the number one factor is the disparity that COVID is affecting the Black communities. Just seeing the amount of A&T alumni or students or faculty saying, you know, I've lost someone, or my grandma is COVID positive, like, say a prayer. Just like a tweet like that, that you just come across, and it's like, the closer it gets to home, the more it really means to you.
While more cases will likely be found as testing ramps up, students Leah Tyson and Brenda Caldwell say their goal is that the A&T family can make it to graduation together. Liz Schlemmer, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Context of white supremacy. So we went throwback all the way. We had albino affairs at the beginning, and now we will get Gus T's reminder about sequencing. Over the years, particularly on the compensatory call-in, I've talked about the significance of the ordering of different reports on the news. Like, generally, it's not random. I don't just toss news reports in the old random sequence. And I don't think when racist white supremacists on Fox News or CBS or NBC or MSNBC or any other news outlets, I don't think that they just toss things out randomly either. So This week on NPR, this is the following sequence. These two reports, this is exactly how they aired on National Public Radio this week, October 2020.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. I always felt it's more romantic when traveling if you don't have to get off the plane through a jetway. Better to climb down steps onto the tarmac and look around. Apparently a dog felt the same. The rescue dog, a Spanish Podenco, was being shipped to Canada. Crystal fled from the cargo hold upon arrival, and the Toronto airport held up flights for an hour until they could find the dog using night vision goggles. It's Morning Edition. Here's one way to get out the vote. Have strippers tell people to cast their ballots. NPR's Juana Summers reports on a public service announcement.
A dancer in white, knee-high, lace-up boots walks away from the camera and toward a silver pole. She grabs the pole with one hand. The beat drops. An assortment of dancers perform pole tricks, one after the other, sometimes together. This is a different kind of public service announcement.
Do we get your attention?
Good. So, you're really not going to vote?
You know it's more than just the president on the ballot, right?
Those were a couple of the dancers featured in the video from director Angela Barnes. She's from Atlanta and said that she was specifically targeting black men there, which led her to pick this approach.
Atlanta has a strip club culture. People go out and go on dates at strip clubs. People get married and have funerals at strip clubs. You know, people don't go there just to see like naked people. You go there for the vibe.
Barnes said that she and producer Paul Fox, who largely paid for the video themselves, along with some crowdsourced fundraising, wanted to make this PSA to fill a gap in traditional get-out-the-vote messaging.
We felt that black men in general are not really, you know, paid attention to by most elected officials. Black people in general are taken for granted, I think, and ignored in politics.
Black Americans are one of the Democratic Party's most loyal constituencies. But when it comes to who turns out to vote, there is a gap between black men and black women. The Pew Research Center estimated that in 2016, 54% of eligible black men said they had voted. Meanwhile, 64% of eligible black women said that they had voted. And that represents a much larger gender gap than for their white or Hispanic counterparts. Mondale Robinson is the founder of the Black Male Voter Project, and he consulted on this video. He said that the ad is effective because it speaks to issues that black men in the state care about, and it does so in a culturally relevant way. He also pushed back against critics who have said the video is too sexual or degrading to the black men that it's trying to reach.
If LeBron James had on a Lakers jersey talking politics right now, no one is going to say anything. So if they have a problem with sisters, dancing, talking about issues that are important, then your real problem is not with the issues or the sisters talking about the issues. It's something that's deeply embedded in you about what is considered decent work and not decent work.
This video doesn't advocate for any party or any specific politician. Instead, the dancers talk about the impact of down ballot votes. The issues mentioned in the ad draw from a series of conversations that Robinson spearheaded with black men across the state of Georgia.
Want trades and coding taught in our schools?
Then vote for the school boards that will prepare us for the job market.
Want to end cash bail?
Well, then vote for the sheriffs and county officials that feel the same way you do.
Barnes described herself as progressive, but said that the video was intentionally not partisan. She said that people, and particularly black men, don't like being told who or what to vote for. Instead, she wanted to keep the focus on the issues.
If they matter to you, then don't let other people decide who's going to run your community.
Get your booty to the poll.
Juana Summers, NPR News.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've told, said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, after day, after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched black people going to jail, black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it is just some of it could be lessened if black people simply voted.
Florida's Republican legislature appears to be succeeding in its drive to prevent people with felony convictions from voting. The people of Florida voted otherwise. 2 years ago, by an overwhelming margin, Floridians overturned the state's lifelong ban on voting for most people who were convicted of felonies and are done serving time. Then Florida lawmakers stepped in. The legislators barred people with felony convictions from voting if they still owe outstanding fines. Danny Rivero of WLRN reports on the result.
The big promise when voters passed a ballot initiative in 2018 was that more than a million Floridians would get the right to vote back. But after the state connected voting with making payments, less than 10,000 ex-felons are expected to vote in November, according to research from Georgetown Law Center. That's because the majority of people can't afford to pay what they owe, even if a tiny percent of them can.
I've paid all my fines. I have paid my debt to society. And now I'm able to vote.
Deshaun Jones came out of Florida State Prison 6 years ago, where she was serving time for drug charges. But when I met her in August, she was marching to the polls in Miami to vote in Florida's primary election.
Get out and go vote!
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 Jones is a social worker now. And for the occasion, she's wearing a homemade black and pink shirt that celebrates how far she's made it.
So my shirt says, she's been reformed. I have DC number, which is Dade County Corrections, crossed out. And I have my voter's registration number checked. So no longer a felon. In my eyes, I'm not.
A few Florida counties have come up with programs that allow judges to modify someone's sentence to allow them to vote, even if money is still owed. When the programs first launched, there was a lot of promise that they could help people register to vote. Democratic State Senator Jason Pizzo helped create one of these programs in Miami-Dade County a year ago. And he says the biggest problem with the program is that so few people have used it.
Less than 100 people of their cases have been modified in the largest county in Florida, in the third largest state in the country.
Pizzo says there's more pro bono attorneys that have offered to help with cases than people who have called for help.
Is it apathy or is it beating down people and basically making them feel so disheartened and disenchanted with the system that, like, I give up. You know, I give up. I don't want to engage. I don't know.
A fund to help would-be voters was created last year and has raised millions so far. But even those charitable contributions are facing pushback from the state. After billionaire Michael Bloomberg announced he would help donate nearly $20 million for the effort, Florida's Attorney General Ashley Moody asked the FBI and state police to investigate. In a letter, she cited laws against election bribery.
It's hard to not see this as a bit of voter intimidation.
Danielle Lang is an attorney with the Campaign Legal Center. She represented plaintiffs in the federal court case. And she says Florida's trying to scare people away from accepting help for paying off their fines and fees.
There is no criminal investigation to be had here. The law is about paying people to vote or paying people in order to induce them to vote. Instead, the generosity of fellow citizens is allowing individuals to become eligible to vote. Most of us don't have to pay to become eligible to vote, but unfortunately, these folks do.
Betty Riddle was a plaintiff in the federal lawsuit, and now she's scrambling to come up with the money she needs to be able to vote in November.
It doesn't make sense, and that's what frustrates me. I mean, it is unbelievable what these people will go through to stop us from voting. I mean, you won. We got to pay.
Riddle says despite all the legal rulings, she's going to keep trying to get her voting rights back, even if it takes until the next presidential election. For NPR News, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Mad as hell. The hospitalization of an American president is a story that pierces every other story in the media. And Trump has played it like he's on Broadway. I can hardly count the guys who've insisted that this is a hoax, that Trump wasn't really sick. I may disagree, but it changes nothing, for he's a man who's hard to believe. Around him, almost a dozen people have fallen ill because of the coronavirus. The United States is awash in COVID-19. And It ain't getting any better. In parts once low in the virus, we've now seen spikes. Trump has ignored it, downplayed it, and likened it to the flu. Downplay it all you want, but this thing is real. And that doesn't mean that this nation isn't sick and getting sicker. Getting through this virus will take time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
As photo opportunities go, it was a memorable one. And with less than a month until the presidential election in the United States, Donald Trump's brief sortie from the hospital where he's being treated for COVID-19 has been dominating the headlines. On Sunday afternoon, amid uncertainty about the exact state of his health, the president waved to cheering supporters outside the Walter Reed Medical Facility near Washington, D.C. This was the reaction from one of his supporters.
He is fighting for America. He is for the American way. I'm for America. I'm for the American way. That is why I am here today, to show love for our support and support for our president. And he's been fighting for us. I'm going to fight for him.
The president has been criticized for putting at risk the safety of his security officers who were sitting with him in the vehicle. Dr. Brett Bruen served as the White House Director of Global Engagement under former President Barack Obama.
My thoughts immediately went to the Secret Service agents that are driving in the vehicle with the president. I just was rather alarmed that the president, his staff, the medical professionals at Walter Reed Hospital would have allowed them to be put in such danger, and all for what? So that the president could create a photo op? It just seemed rather ridiculous and, quite frankly, rather appalling.
Shortly before we recorded this podcast, I caught up with our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, who's outside the Walter Reed Hospital in Maryland.
There are a few supporters here outside the hospital across the street from where I'm talking to you now. Not that many, but a few. They're demonstrating their support for the president. And, of course, they were very pleased with his little drive-by yesterday. But it did cause some outrage, particularly some of the doctors actually inside Walter Reed Medical Center who thought it was irresponsible and reckless. So there's been a lot of sort of bemusement and surprise that he chose to do that, particularly, of course, because knowing that he had the virus, he was also in a car with two Secret Service officers, albeit in full PPE, we are told, but it was a sealed car and, you know, there was no doubt a risk that they were put at.
President Trump has been tweeting in the last few hours, now he's back in the hospital, urging people to vote. Do you sense with him and his campaign that there's a lot of frustration that they're not out there with less than a month to go till the election?
I think that's probably true. This whole barrage of tweets that we've seen in the last hour or so, I think there are more than a dozen now, don't mention his illness at all. They're all about the economy, about law and order, about the election and voting, about the stock market, about all these kinds of areas, specifically calling out some states over others. And this, I think, is the president trying to say, look, I'm in full campaign mode. This isn't the actions and the words of a man who is sort of suffering in his bed. And I think that's an attempt, perhaps, as well, to try and get rid of or move the agenda on from all that confusion over the weekend over the nature of his illness and when he became ill and how ill he became, and of course that very controversial drive-by yesterday where he came out to meet his supporters.
Now, there had been suggestions from his medical team that he might be discharged today. Any more news on that?
Nothing official about that. That's clearly something they wish to do. I mean, bear in mind he is on these intravenous treatments. It seems that they can be given at the White House because we think some of those did start while he was at the White House. But I think they will want to avoid, if at all possible, a sort of yo-yoing back and forward between the hospital, particularly because he may not be past the sort of the crucial, critical point in the sort of trajectory of the illness where it can get, you know, a lot worse after a week or so in some patients.
And presumably he's still infectious.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to ask an epidemiologist. I mean, particularly because we don't actually properly know when the first real diagnosis was. And so that's very difficult to say precisely how long it's going to go. And I think there's, you know, the scientists will tell you there's variation in this, the amount of time, how long you're infectious for, and does that depend on the viral load that you've got and how sick you are. Some people we know, maybe even 40% of people can pass it on without a sign of a symptom of their own. So all these are big unknowns, and they apply to, you may be the President of the United States, but they apply to him like any other human being.
Gary O'Donoghue.
New charges tonight against the Central West End couple accused of pointing guns at protesters over the summer. This as they railed against city officials today, saying the government is persecuting them. News 4's Lauren Traeger was in the courtroom today and was the first to break the news of the charges.
Well, this is certainly a big development. A grand jury, of course, can always choose not to indict someone, but the grand jury here in this case chose to indict and also add additional charges. The defense attorney, though, in the case says that's not surprising. He believes the grand jury simply did not have all of the facts. In fact, News 4 has learned that the lead investigator for the police that's been investigating this case was never called to testify before the grand jury.
In this case, I believe once all the facts are out, it will be clear that neither McCloskey committed any crime whatsoever.
Defense attorney Joel Schwartz says he's not surprised that Mark and Patricia McCloskey have been indicted.
Frankly, because the grand jury is not an adversarial process, defense counsel are not allowed in there, and I have no idea whatsoever what was stated to the grand jury and what law was given to the grand jury.
The McCloskeys had previously been charged with felony counts of exhibiting weapons for pointing guns at protesters outside their Central West End home. They have long maintained they were protecting themselves and their property from people hurling threats. But the grand jury also added a count for each of them. Tampering. This, we're told, stems from the pistol held by Patricia McCloskey and later turned over to police by attorney Al Watkins. The gun, Watkins maintains, had been rendered inoperable, but a report obtained by News 4 from the St. Louis Police Crime Lab showed that a prosecutor had instructed the examiners to reassemble it correctly, all of which could be an issue in the ongoing case.
Every single human being who was in front of my house was a criminal trespasser. They broke down our gate. They trespassed on our property. Not a single one of those people is now charged with anything.
Fired up on the courthouse steps earlier Tuesday, Mark McCloskey railed against city officials, saying it was frightening that they were charged, while last week city officials declined to file any charges against protesters on citations for trespassing.
What you're witnessing here in this case is just an opportunity for the government, the leftist Democrat government of the city of St. Louis, to persecute us for doing no more than exercising our Second Amendment rights.
Now, the city councilor's office declined to comment on those trespassing citations today. We have also reached out to the prosecutor's office to learn more about that indictment and to get their comment, but despite multiple attempts to get a hold of them today, we have still not heard back. The McCloskeys will be back here in court next week, and of course, you can count on News 4 to be there. Reporting live downtown, Lauren Traeger, News 4.
The man nut, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
On Wednesday, we did not see the interaction between Wolf City officer Sean Lucas and Jonathan Price before Price was shot and killed, but Texas Rangers confirmed it exists. The one-page arrest affidavit released says the entire incident was captured on Lucas's body-worn camera. According to the affidavit, Lucas responded Saturday night to the Quick Check convenience store about a possible fight. Price's family said the 31-year-old had just broken up a fight between two people he did not know. When Lucas arrived, the affidavit says Price approached him asking, quote, "You doing good," multiple times while extending his hand in a handshake gesture. Officer Lucas told a Texas Ranger investigator he thought Price was drunk and tried to arrest him. The affidavit says Price responded, "I can't be detained." Officer Lucas then got out a taser, and Price started to walk away. The affidavit says the taser wasn't fully effective, and while being tased, Price walked towards the officer and appeared to reach and grab the end of the taser. The detective says that's when Officer Lucas fired his gun four times, striking Price in the upper body.
I think what you're seeing now is, from what we, as opposed to what we've seen in previous years, is now law enforcement's going to arrest the police officer.
Toby Shook is a criminal defense attorney not associated with this case. He says a probable cause affidavit for murder simply shows a killing by intentional act. Price's family has asked for video to be released in this case, something the Hunt County DA's office, as of now, has not done.
You are going to have tremendous public pressure that wants to see the evidence in these cases. Of course, that could taint your jury pool.
A jury that likely won't see all of the evidence, including that body camera video, for several more months. In Dallas, I'm David Goins.
Jonathan Price will be laid to rest this weekend. Public visitation is Friday from 10 to 6 at Love and Integrity Funeral Services in Greenville. His homegoing service is Saturday morning at 11 on the Wolf City High School football field.
National conversation around police violence has focused on police shootings, but a comprehensive year-long investigation from the Marshall Project is shedding light on another lesser-known form of violence that causes harm to thousands every year, attacks by police dogs. According to their report, there's little oversight on how departments train and use these animals, despite cases like this one out of West Montgomery, Alabama in 2018.
There was a call late at night about a person in an unoccupied house. The police, the Montgomery City Police, sent in the canine unit. They found Joseph Petaway, 51, in the house. He had been fixing up the house earlier in the day. The family said he had a key and had permission to sleep in this small house. The canine found him, bit him. The bite lasted maybe 2 minutes, and Joseph Petaway bled to death.
That's Challen Stevens, editor and investigative reporter for the Birmingham News, Huntsville Times, and Mobile Press Register, who co-reported the investigation. That case is the worst case scenario, but it points to the risks of a system with little accountability. So as the nation examines policing, why isn't there more attention to how and when police dogs are employed? Abby Van Sickle is here to talk about all of this. She's staff writer for the Marshall Project covering criminal justice and was the other reporter on this investigation. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abby, why did you begin this investigation about police dogs?
You know, it really started with a string of cases in Alabama where Challen and I started to try to understand the scope of how often police dogs are used to bite people, what kind of injuries people would suffer from these bites, and then what oversight there was. And the more cases that we saw, the more we realized that this was not just happening in Alabama, but was actually happening, you know, coast to coast and everything in between.
When researching police dog bites, how tough was it to find that information?
You know, some things were pretty simple to find if there had been local news coverage of an incident, especially if there's sort of a video involved. We would see local news stories, but what we really didn't see was any kind of national examination trying to put these incidents together. And that's when we started requesting data from departments, and it got a lot more difficult to find things like how often are these dogs used, how often do they actually bite people, and what kind of accountability is there when a bite happens, especially if there's a dog that has, you know, bitten numerous people or an officer who's been involved in lots of incidents. We started to see, you know, we wanted to see if there was any kind of national database tracking this, and we didn't find that. So we started to try to build something where we could see the scope.
Abby, what kinds of injuries do these dogs inflict?
This is one of the things that surprised me most in the reporting is the severity of some of the injuries. So what we found is that it's not a dog bite like you might think of, you know, like a nip from a family pet. What we saw were injuries that, you know, people would suffer lifelong consequences from these dog bites. We saw people who had lost their scalps, who had lost limbs, who had these scars that, you know, they would carry with them throughout their lives. And so that seemed to be, you know, an important thing that came from a lot of the interviews we had with victims of the bites, that they really carried this with them forever.
Abby, how much funding is allocated to the training and use of these dogs?
You know, I think that's an excellent question and something that we would really like to know. One thing that we did determine is that, each department has a lot of discretion in how and when they use the dogs, how many dogs they have. We found some departments that the dogs, are donated through foundations to the departments. There is no clear, clear process for each department. It's very much, something where you have to get into the weeds of a particular agency to understand.
Do we know how many people are getting bitten by police dogs and how big this issue is? And to what extent race or gender play into these numbers?
So what we can say about the number is that we looked at a medical study that examined police dog bites in emergency rooms. And that study estimated there were a few thousand bites a year. We have been able to track bites by the 20 largest municipal policing agencies. So we have some sense, to try to back that number up. But we don't know, a precise number for how many bites there are each year in the United States. As far as race and gender, one thing from the cases, we examined about 140 cases from the last couple of years, and the overwhelming number of people were men. We found very few women, and that's also backed up by the academic studies we've been able to find. With race, it's a little bit more difficult because we had asked departments specifically for race data, and we don't have that from very many departments. We do have hints that there, in some places, that there's been disproportionate use of the dogs on people of color. We see that in the Department of Justice investigation into Ferguson. We see it in an examination from a few years ago of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. We see it in in a few places, but we really would love to be able to take a systemic view of this from departments throughout the country.
Abby, who trains these dogs, and are there specific guidelines for their training?
So that's, again, an agency-specific thing. So some departments, large departments, will have training within their own policing agency. And we, as reporters, spent time watching some of those trainings. But also there are, small kind of mom-and-pop trainers throughout the country, and then some sort of independent larger training organizations. It's sort of a hodgepodge, again, very department-specific. And there are not national requirements for training in any kind of standardized way.
Given that there's no consistency in the training, is there consistency in the types of crimes that have to be committed in order for dogs to be used?
That's another thing that we found is very dependent on the agencies. So in some agencies, we found to use the dog, it has to be a very serious crime, a violent felony with a very specific list of the kinds of cases. In other places, there's broad discretion for officers. We also found supervision really depends on the agency. In some places, a supervisor really has to sign off before a dog can be used. And in other places, the dogs we found had been used on people who were accused of very low-level crimes. We're talking traffic stop, an expired license plate, things that are, considered very low-level.
Abby, just briefly, given that police reform and racial equality are in the spotlight right now in this country, do you think departments will stop using police dogs, or is there any organization fighting this?
So we are starting to see a reexamination of the use of police dogs in some departments throughout the country. Salt Lake City Police Department had a video that was released recently showing a man with his hands in the air as the dog was being released on him, inviting him. And in the wake of that, the department has suspended the use of these kinds of dogs, the kind of dogs that are used to bite people, as they examine that incident.
Abby Van Sickle is staff writer for the Marshall Project covering criminal justice. Thanks for this information and joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's being called one of the most important court rulings in Greece's history. In Athens, the far-right party Golden Dawn has been declared a criminal organisation, and more than 60 of its leaders and members have been found guilty of running or belonging to it. Thousands of anti-fascist protesters had come to demonstrate outside the court, and there were some clashes with police who responded with water cannon and tear gas. Anna Stamou of the Muslim Association of Greece told reporters the outcome of the trial was a great victory for democracy.
We have been waiting for this for 5.5 years since this trial started, and this whole process was a struggle. We feel very relieved because we managed to see the Golden Dawn as a criminal organization. This is the most important thing. But also the individual cases were judged very fairly according to what evidence the prosecutors brought. And that was a historical moment for Greece.
Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen was based in Athens during the rise of Golden Dawn. And he told me more about the case and its significance.
They've been convicted of belonging to a criminal organisation and indeed leading that organisation. These are seven of the former MPs, including the party leader, who have been convicted, and dozens of other members of the party as well have also been convicted. The charges included murder, an attempted murder, violent attacks, possession of illegal weapons. This is a party that was known for carrying out widespread violence, Alex, and what the court had to prove was that there was a direct chain of command between the leadership of Golden Dawn and assault groups, effectively, that were given orders from the top leadership in a kind of pyramid-like structure to go out and carry out attacks on political opponents and migrants. I remember when I was based in Athens in around 2011, 2012, as the party was really soaring in the polls, I used to speak to migrants who would show me their stab wounds when they were being attacked. There was the murder in 2013 of a left-wing rapper, Pavlos Fissas, which then led to the trial against Golden Dawn. And for a country that was occupied by the Nazis during the Second World War, to suddenly have this neo-Nazi group soaring in popularity on the back of austerity measures and waves of migration, getting into parliament, eventually becoming the third largest party in parliament, was a real shock.
They were the third largest party in Parliament, but now they've got, what, 3% of the vote and no MPs. Are they over?
They are all but over, I would say. As you say, they didn't cross the threshold to enter Parliament in last year's elections. So they are a shadow of what they were in their height in 2012, 2013, when they had 21 MPs at one point. In 2015, the election, they became the third largest party. I remember, actually, an extraordinary moment in early 2012 when each party had to go and was tasked with forming a government, because Greece was unable to form a government at that stage. And I remember that the Greek president at that stage, who had actually fought against the Nazis during the Second World War, had to summon the leader of Golden Dawn, this neo-Nazi party, into the presidential palace and task him with forming government, which he couldn't do, so that was a failed attempt. But it was just, the symbolism was so strong. You know, the party leader denied the gas chambers. There was Nazi paraphernalia found in MPs' homes. The party doesn't sort of exist in the same way as it did. It doesn't have any MPs. But there is a fringe of far-right opinion that still exists, and a new party has been founded that has 1.5% support in the polls, founded by a former member of Golden Dawn. So, you know, among a fringe of Greek public opinion that is still weary from the financial crisis, still weary from waves of migration, the ideology still exists.
Mark Lowen, our Southern Europe correspondent.
From NPR News in Washington, it's All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The FBI announced today it was charging six people with conspiring to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Democrat Gretchen Whitmer. Here she is speaking earlier this afternoon.
When I put my hand on the Bible,
and took the oath of office 22 months ago, I knew this job would be hard. But I'll be honest, I never could have imagined anything like this.
The complaint alleges a plan to violently overthrow the state government, abduct the governor before next month's election, and put her on trial for treason. Well, Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel is also bringing charges against seven other people related to the plot, ranging from providing material support for terrorist acts to gang membership, among others. Attorney General Nessel, it's good to speak with you again. I'm sorry it's under such bizarre circumstances.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I know there's things you can't get into, ongoing investigation and all of that, but what can you tell us about how the state and the FBI came to learn of this plot?
Well, it's something that a joint task force had been following for quite some time. Unfortunately, this is not just a Michigan problem. This is an American problem right now, and we've heard the FBI director say in the past that white supremacy groups, militia groups, domestic terrorism posed one of the biggest threats that we have to the United States today, and I concur with that. I think he's right. But these are groups in multiple states, multiple jurisdictions that have been operating and really taking advantage of the unrest in American society right now. I think they're taking advantage of the COVID epidemic, the Black Lives Matter unrest, and they're using it to recruit and to formulate plots. And we saw that, in real time here in Michigan, involving not just the plot to kidnap the governor, but the plot to overtake the Michigan Capitol and potentially kill a number of public officials there, and even threats and efforts to execute those involved in law enforcement. So a number of different plots.
And you said officials have been tracking this for quite some time. Did I catch that right? So do we know when this first started coming together? How far back does this go?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on what part of the activities you're talking about. You know, these are groups that have been around, but we've just seen
this specific plot involving Governor Whitmer. Do we know?
Well, I would say when the executive orders came down, which would have started in March, and things started to escalate from there. You may remember that we had quite an incident at our Capitol occur shortly after that, and things started to escalate from there, and that's when it turned just from a lot of rhetoric, a lot of angry rhetoric, into actual overt acts and trainings, multi-state trainings.
You're talking about protests this summer, which I want to get to in a minute, but can you tell us how close this group was to succeeding in carrying out these plans?
Well, I mean, they were at the point where they were in the process of training for it and had multiple exercises. So obviously we felt as though they were close enough in time that there could be, actual actions, actual efforts to execute these plots. And to me, what I always say is I would rather have the weakest conspiracy case rather than the strongest homicide. Now, this is not a weak conspiracy case at all whatsoever. I think it's a very strong case. But obviously, we were concerned that the governor's life was actually in jeopardy. And that's why we had over 200 both state and federal agents take place in these multiple execution search warrants and arrests that went down yesterday.
One more detail I'm hoping you can shed some light on. I know you said earlier today that the people your office is charging are linked to the Wolverine Watchmen. This is what you call a militia group. In her press conference today, Governor Whitmer talked about two militia groups. Are there two different groups? What do we know about this?
There's actually multiple groups involved. The people that we charged are affiliated with this Wolverine Watchmen group, and you could probably tell by the name Wolverine that they are a Michigan-based group. But there are multiple white supremacy groups and militia groups that have been acting in accordance with one another. Ultimately, their mission is what they call the Boogaloo, right? It's an uprising or a civil war. And there are a number of groups that are acting in concert based on, a shared extreme ideology. This effort to have a mass uprising nationally, and, it's something that we should be very concerned about because, again, it's not just a Michigan problem. This is now an American problem.
Although to fill in a little bit more of the context that is specific to Michigan, your capital, we mentioned, saw protests this summer. These were linked to coronavirus restrictions, people who weren't happy about coronavirus restrictions, protesters showing up with signs depicting violence against Governor Whitmer, who became the face of those restrictions. Have you been able to track any specific connection between those protesters, those protests, and this alleged plot?
Yes.
Can you elaborate?
Well, I think that when there's a review of the individuals that were there at that protest, you will see that many of these individuals that were charged were at that protest. I think that those protests were used actually as recruiting stations to add more members and to find people that were angry with the governor, angry with the government, and frankly, I think encouraged by the words of our president.
You're referring to remarks about white supremacists. We've just got a few seconds left, but how's Governor Whitmer doing?
I think she's shaken. She gave a statement a little while ago. We've kept her up.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 10, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, observations. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before we get started, I'll give a plug. We are continuing with our book club, Isabel Wilkerson, Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents. Tragic. This is a new book, right? Just published a few weeks ago. Very popular. Lots of folks are reading it right now. If you are reading it, thinking about reading it, particularly if you were with us when we read The Warmth of Other Suns, if you heard that book section, I've referenced The Warmth of Other Suns so frequently. It's in my top 10. It has so much just informative, painful information about the system of white supremacy racism. Cased is not that book for many, many reasons, but tune in to the book club. We have had robust commentary thus far, so yeah, should be informative to read, analyze with other victims of white supremacy and try and make sense. Lots of metaphors. Wow, that is a great illustration of why this program, we recommend, request that participants not use metaphors. But that is the book club. As Dr. Welsing would say, reading is more important than watching television. That is Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the book club. Now, to share before we get to the callers this week. Wow, so many things to discuss. Let's see. Let's start with the beginning. Albino Affairs. I don't know how long people have been listening. If we make it to February, Black History Month, it'll be a dozen years since we returned to the air in 2009. Albino Affairs, I believe, started sometime around 2012 on the compensatory call-in. We don't have it every single week, but it's been a pretty regular feature for about the last 7.5 years on the compensatory call-in. Reason, explanation. Now, in a system of white supremacy, racism, individuals classified as white terrorize and abuse everyone that they classify as not white, we have Remember Justice the Horse that was in the Washington Post. I was talking to Mr. Fuller about that. This is a horse who originally was named Shadow. Black horse, was beaten, mauled, terrorized. They had to castrate its penis, left out in the cold. Big article in the Washington Post about Shadow the Horse. Changed his name to Justice, and now he's got a constitutional case. Remember the report we did in the middle of this summer? Negro Kitten Day. They talked about what a tough time Negro kittens get. Nobody wants to adopt them. Don't want them hanging around, wear their pants hanging off their behind. Remember that for Negro Kitten Day? So we have all that for, that's how the Negro animals, even in backstage racism and all that, Joe Feagin's book, Two-Faced Racism. He says, squiggers. It was a particular region where they have black squirrels, and they nicknamed them, the white people nicknamed them squiggers. Squirrels, niggers. So we have all these illustrations of the black animal. Now we have Lucky, the albino squirrel. Squiggers? Lucky, the albino squirrel. Mascot in the town, in fact. It is the creepiest thing ever. They have someone in like a probably 6 foot albino white rodent costume with red eyes. Like, who wants to see that running around on the side? How is that inspirational for the team? Like, good Lord, let's get out of here. What is going on? They got chemically altered rodents, my God. But there's so many illustrations of that. That's how albino affairs became a regular feature, because that's not just a one-time thing. That's an all-the-time, all-over-the-world. We had Migala, I believe, was the name. It was an albino whale in Australia, and they would just lose their minds. Oh, we got to jump out in the water and half drown. Look at Migala, the albino whale. And all these other little critters, and they will say the same thing. These little albino critters have a hard time. The sun is a little difficult for them. It's hard for them to see. They're so vulnerable. Oh, man, they have a tough time, these critters that don't have melanin. Why is it that individuals classified as white identify so with albino critters? We even talked to Dr. Welsing. We took one of the segments that was talking about the albino critters and how it's difficult for them to find a mate. And it was a lengthy, it was about 3 minutes, where they had, I think, a zoologist come in, and it was the same thing, gushing. I think it might have been an albino alligator or something. And Dr. Welsing, I think this is 2012, right before the re-election of Obama. And she went into detail and talked about, what is this fascination? But yes, even the return of albino affairs this week. Lucky, the albino. There's video for that. I'll post the video so you can see Lucky, the albino squirrel. Context of white supremacy. Next. Governor Gretchen Whitmer. I guess maybe she was lucky this week. I'm not sure. So they had a plot where it was the photo that I saw. It had 13 look like white men are accused of plotting to kidnap the governor. And that this plot is associated with white supremacy and the Boogaloo movement. Now, we talked about way back in, when was that? April, the spring of this year, when there were gangs of whites across the U.S. who were upset disgruntled about the Rona restrictions and the lockdown, and you're not going to tell me to wear a mask, you're not going to tell me to wash my hands or social distance, not going to tell me to close my gun store. We talked about all of that. That was that white defiance. That was what I labeled it. That was happening across the land. And then in Michigan, you had gangs of whites going to the state capitol. We're going to show these legislatures, got our firearms, went in the state. Some of them stood outside with their long barrel firearms. Then some of them went inside and were yelling at law enforcement officials and what have you. Some of them didn't even have a mask on. Spittle was flying everywhere. All of this was, going on, you know, for days. I think it might have even been weeks that this was going on. Now, I said then, and I think many people did. Can you imagine if some black people had went out and did this? Even said, we're going in front of the city pound. We're upset with the way that they treat the albino dogs. We're going to go in front of the pound and protest with a slingshot. Man, I'm not going to be in the group that tries that one. That was just, you know, a few months ago. And I said then, how is this even being allowed? Where you can go with firearms and yell at and intimidate elected officials, even in the state capitol. You're not just outside. They were in the state capitol doing this. How is this even legal? How is it surprising then that some of the very folks that were engaged in this behavior, which should have been deemed criminal then, may have in fact come up with a criminal plot? Hey, why not just kidnap one of these law officials, elected officers that we don't like, that's coming up with all these wacky Rona plans, saying we got to wear a mask and shut down? Why don't we just kidnap her? Yeah, that's a good idea. System of racism, white supremacy. Wow, what a year. We had some folks on social media I saw who were saying they wish this had happened. I don't know if that violates the social media policy. Like, that came up several times this week. They were saying you can't go on social media platforms and wish that the president dies from the Rona. That might mean that you also can't wish that Governor Whitmer or another elected official gets kidnapped. But it has been just amazing. Even for elected officials, remember they had Mayor Lucas, he's in Missouri. He said, let's wear masks. You go outside, you know, you got to wear a mask. The Rona is, you know, serious. They said he should be hung from a tree. That was just in the middle of the summer. That's how one of my Facebook pages got taken down. I just posted the news report. Mayor Lucas threatened with lynching for requesting that citizens wear masks. And they said, oh, yeah, well, you can't post hate speech. System of white supremacy. If you don't understand white supremacy, racism, like, you have a very difficult time, I think, making sense, putting all of the events that are happening in such rapid succession in some sort of context as to why all of this is happening. I would even add, with the Governor Whitmer situation, that is racism, white supremacy. That's according to the report, Boogaloo Movement and all. We talked about that throughout the year repeatedly. It's really close to the election. Michigan is an important state. If the FBI foiled this plot, which that's what they say, this could be for publicity. Hey, these white supremacists are out here, and what do we call it? Racial focal pointing. We'll say it's the white supremacists are out here, and they've been emboldened by that president. Vote for Biden-Harris. I'm not saying that's what it is. I'm just saying that it is very close to the election. Many staged events take place for the election. I'll just say it that way. This event, like I said, kidnapping the governor by a group of alleged, suspected race soldiers, Wow. Super newsworthy. We should all pay attention. I hope they have a big trial. But it is close to election season. Speaking of election season, I did the sequencing, right, of what they aired on NPR Morning Edition from this week. So they had the about 30-second segment on the dog at the Toronto airport. He escapes, and they said it delayed the flight for like 90 minutes, right? Lucky the albino squirrel. Dog at the airport, they hold it up for 90 minutes. Negro Kitten Day. Really, any black person. John Price, now just, you know, for the scale of things. But so NPR, they have the 30-second report. The dog gets to cause a melee at the Toronto airport. I was supposed to be there this year. And then that is followed by, you better, you know, twerk your booty to the pole and vote. Down in Atlanta. I saw that, the PSA that they were airing for all that, the strippers, you know, trying to register and all, maybe 2 weeks ago. And again, if you don't understand the system of white supremacy. Now, if you want to encourage people to go out and vote, they have a billion different ways to do that. I know people who graduated in advertisement. That's their field. That's what they do. Be creative. Be imaginative. It's lots of different ways that you can encourage people to vote. If anything, I would think a big part of it would be, this is serious. Supreme Court Justice, our fan, our hero, RBG, passed away this year. Who's going to pick her successor? It's the president. If you don't think that's serious, get out there and vote, right? They could have done that. They could have put some great music in it. They could have put some, you know, stars in it. It's Atlanta. They could have got Dwight Howard. He's in the finals right now. They could have got Dwight Howard. Atlanta's finest. Hey, Dwight, what do you got to say? Lakers in the finals. Forget that championship. Nothing is more important than voting. Right? That's a good one. Local hero. Tons of different. What do we think of? Black, because this isn't white people. They didn't go and get, like, Miley Cyrus. They didn't go and get some white people, a white woman, and say, oh, yeah, we want to get a bunch of white women and shake it. Yeah, get out there and shake it. Shake it on to the... That's not what they did. We want to get black females. This is what we... And again, now, the sequence was dog loose at the airport. And then we come over hyper sexualized black females, strippers, because that's all they're good for, you know. Shake it to the pole. That's how we'll motivate black people, right? This must be aimed at black people. Like, in that. I don't know who this ad would be targeting in Atlanta, a city that is notoriously thought of as a black city. Who would this ad be targeting? Is this targeting Trump supporters? I mean, they had gentlemen's clubs, right? That's what they call it. They have that for white people, too. White people have done that. That's what the slave auction is in some respects. But that's the sort of political advertising that we get in 2020 in the midst of all this conversation about racism and, you know, how people are depicted and images and all of that. That's the propaganda, that's the campaign pitch that we come up with to get black people in Atlanta to vote. Yes. 4 more years. If people think that, you know, Gus is being a little crazy with regards to the sequence, that doesn't mean anything. To have a loose dog, may have been a B-I-T-C-H, right, at the airport. And then strippers on the pole, twerk it to the voting booth. Maybe I'm, you know, just being a little ignorant. Could be. It's been a stressful year with the Rona and all. Next, Jonathan Price, victim of white supremacy, I said consistently, almost for the full 12 years, I'm not really interested in all of these, you know, police shootings. I don't follow these cases. I don't watch the video. I don't know if there's video for the Jonathan Price situation, but I didn't. Even if there is, I wouldn't watch it. But I generally don't, you know, check for all of that. I will try to just do the bare minimum. Since, you know, I operate a public platform and someone might ask me about the case, I feel like I at least should know who this person is. Like, oh, okay, I know, you know, some of the bare minimum details about it, but this is not going to be something that I'm following and out protesting every day and, you know, no justice. Man. These incidents are going to happen. Just try to make sure as best you can that it's not you. Now, I posted about this incident. One detail that I saw was that Mr. Price allegedly intervened to break up a fight. And I said, man, maybe we should rethink being what they call it a good Samaritan to go in and try to break up a fight. I'm just thinking, I think Eric Garner, I think the same thing happened. They accused him of selling cigarettes, but I believe it was a fight happened, and they said the same thing, that he went to intervene to break up this fight, and then, you know, police and blah, blah, blah. And I've heard this a few times, where there was some sort of altercation, an individual stepped in to try to break things up, and then that individual, the police came, and that person got arrested or what have. In fact, I can even recall, I was working, this was some years ago, I was working when I lived in California, and some of my coworkers, they were having a conversation about O.J. Simpson, of course. And I just walked in the middle of the conversation. At that time, I was more confused about racism. And I didn't really have an opinion on the O.J. Simpson case. I hadn't followed it that closely. I didn't have a major opinion on it. And I walked in on the middle of their discussion. And they were talking about O.J. And the white guy was saying, I think he did it. And blah, 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 and all the rest of that. And they said, well, what do you think? I knew the people that they said, well, what do you think about the OJ thing? And I said, man, I don't really have an opinion. I do know that it's a little bit unusual for black people to be able to get away with crimes in this part of the world. Like, I was confused about racism, but I wasn't that confused. So that was my response. I don't really have an opinion on OJ, but it's generally, black people don't get away with crimes in this part of the world, especially against white people. So at that moment, a different black person walked in. So he comes in. I'm not sure if he heard my answer, but I think he may have. I think he may have just heard what I said. So they involve him in the discussion. So he says there was some sort of altercation between a white person and another white person. Black guy went to intervene to break things up. The police were called and they arrested the black guy. So I guess he had to hear what I said for him to make that sort of response, which is further. Black people generally don't get away with crimes, especially against white people in this part of the world. But I remember that incident even when I read what happened to Mr. Price, and I just said, man, I don't know if I'm going to break up a fight publicly, for a lot of reasons. Now, I mean, you got the Rona. If I intervene, am I going to have to get close enough that somebody might breathe on me or could, you know, touch me or any of the rest of it? Lots of reasons. These folks could be armed. I think the security guard, we talked about that on Workplace Racism yesterday. There was a black female security guard in Malibu, California. She went to intervene to get these two white people to stop arguing. The white woman bit her finger and drew blood. They called the police. She's facing felony charges. I hope she does lots of years in jail. But that just happened this week. So I would not recommend intervening to break up a fight. We had talked about this before. We talked about this some years before. We even got Mr. Fuller's view on it because some people were saying, you know, if they see an altercation happen in public, I'm duty bound. I got to intervene. Victims guaranteeing qualified, VGQ, you can do that. I think Mr. Fuller, myself, and some others said there are lots of unknown unknowns in these type of situations. The best thing you can do, even if it's a female involved, sometimes the best thing you can do, if you can help them or help guide them to flee, exit, and or if you want to call the enforcement officials. But so many things. You just do not know what could happen when you go to try to get involved in those type of situations. It really is one of those type of things you have to think, am I ready to die? Am I ready to go to jail to get involved with someone that I may or may not even know? That was one thing, one major point from the situation with Mr. Price. Now, the second component, I shared that on social media, and with what I just said, the suggestion, or at least the question, maybe we should rethink intervening. If there's some sort of physical altercation in public, maybe that's not the time to intervene. Now, I posted this. Other individuals, I don't know them, so these might be individuals classified as white. They might be victims of racism. I don't know. But they posted, and they showed screenshots allegedly purporting to be the victim, Mr. Price, saying, I'm paraphrasing, but basically saying that racism doesn't exist, or it's certainly not a big deal. Black people kind of blame their problems on racism, and white people, that he's known tons of white people that were fantastic and super friendly and not racist, that he in fact has known white enforcement officers who have been spectacular and super friendly and not racist, who helped him out at times. And conversely, he's known black people who were not helpful, courteous at all, and that he might even be feverish for white women. I'm paraphrasing, but that is kind of the gist of most of the major points in this this social media post that is being attributed to Mr. Price. I would say the exact same thing, even if this could be blue check verified. You know, we got fingerprints, we got DNA, timestamp, we got a notary who watched him type out all of what I just said verbatim. He said all that. Okay, even if that's the case, what did I just say? Victims, guaranteed, qualified. VGQ to Mr. Price, most non-white people are confused about racism, white supremacy, yes? Okay, and he's dead. The important thing, he was killed, so it's not like we could go and beat him up. What did you say about them white ones? Coon, I'll beat, you know, we can't even do that. He's dead. So, VGQ. Oh, no. That's not what happened on social media. It was, what? He was feverish. Oh, you think I'm going to go out and protest when you got a coon talking like that? And then, look, see, that's what I thought about. How embarrassing. And I was especially embarrassed to have all the computer problems that I had last week and couldn't get online. We couldn't even do the compensatory call-in last week to get back online. And that's like one of the first things to see. Dead black male. It's not even like, oh, I just am, you know, I don't have anything to say. He's a coon and whatever. Oh, no. I got to get on and talk about it. I engage some of these folks who, again, they might be classified as white. You never know when it's a social media platform. That's why I hate all of this stuff and wouldn't be on it. Anyway, so I engage, but I ask questions. Okay, so Mr. Price, who is dead, by the way, he was a coon. He was feverish. He didn't think racism exists. He hated black people in general. He hated black females. I don't think he said he hated black females, but we'll just add that just for the sake of argument. He loved white women, and he loved police officers. What should be done at this point since he's dead? Now, some of the folks, their response was, I will never speak his name again. I'll say it again, VGQ. No problem there, but if that's the conclusion that you've come to, why are you posting to begin with? The logic would dictate, this person's a coon, I'm not going to speak their name again, so if I see a social media post about this person, I'm on mute. In fact, I might mute that whole conversation, not I'm going to hop online and talk about what a coon and no-count feverish dead black male this is. That doesn't seem to follow the logic of, I'm never going to mention this person's name again. I saw this repeatedly. I saw this repeatedly, not just with Mr. Price. I've seen this over and over. Black male in Sacramento, they did the exact same thing. Oh, we're going to pro. Oh, wait a minute. What did he say on so? Oh, forget that dead coon. Let's go litter on his gravesite. Again, VGQ, if that's the position that you take, that, you know, if it's a black person, a black male in particular, and they happen to be killed by an enforcement official, race soldier, random white person, and we can sift through their social media or social media that is attributed to them and happen to find a post where they said something offensive, objectionable, said racism didn't exist, said something against black people, and that's all it takes. I'm not going to protest. I'm not going to do any hashtag activism, as they call it. In fact, this no-count coon got what he deserved. Wow. That is so much of what we talk about in terms of how we have been conditioned. That is so much in terms of what we talk about in terms of black self-respect being annihilated. That is the epitome of why I say on this program, do not ever call me brother. All of that is nonsense. To sit up and say how much we care about black people, I said this for years, Mr. Fuller. When Nipsey Hussle passed away, lots of black people, when we come out and pretend how much we love and care about black people, when that's about all it takes for you to be a no-count coon. Mr. Price is dead. I mean, we could, I guess, go urinate on his gravesite. We could do that, but it would seem, even if he was the worst coon ever, worse than Al Sharpton, he's dead. What good does it serve to sit around and talk bad about a dead black male? I'll put money on the table right now. Again, how bad I have underestimated the black misandry. If you can think of one case of a black female where this has happened, she was killed unjustly. We were going to protest, do our hashtag activism for whatever that's worth, and then, wait a minute, I found a tweet from 2010. She took a selfie with Hillary Clinton. She said black people do a lot of complaining unnecessarily about racism. Not going to do any marching for Renisha McBride. Nah, all done. Sorry. So sad what happened to you, but you are out of here. We are not talking about you anymore ever again. If you can think of one time this has happened. They even came out with suspicion of criminal activity with Breonna Taylor. Did that just happen where they said, oh man, she might have been involved in some drug smuggling? They didn't say, oh man, I don't get down with drug peddling. Like, man, we got super predators, too many of them out here. Get out of here. You have to get somebody else. We need a better. When has that happened? I'll even go all the way back. We can go back civil rights era. They would have different cases, right? They had Recy Taylor. It wasn't just Rosa Parks. And sometimes they would say, oh, no, that's not a good case because she's pregnant. Or, no, that won't. That's not the same thing at all. I didn't hear anybody, like large groups of people, come out and, ah, oh, Recy Taylor is a no-count coon. I didn't hear that at all. It was just, oh, this isn't a good case. Can't take this one. I don't think we'll get enough popular support. That didn't happen with Mr. Price. It was lots and lots name-calling, black misandry. That is how much we care for Brother Price. I removed quite a few folks from my social media page. I have no idea why in the world are you following Gus T. Renegade or listening to the context of white supremacy if that is your conclusion, that black people need to be name-called. We shouldn't think of black people as being victims of white supremacy. We should think of them as being, you know, no-count coons, and we got to call them names. Even in death, we got to talk bad about them and that sort of thing. I have no idea what that means. I even had some folks who tweeted out, we just get so frustrated, Gus. It's so frustrating to have these victims who sit up and make excuses for Karens. I did the same thing. So, in a system of white supremacy, are white people more frustrating? Or are dead black people more frustrating? Again, if somebody can think of one black female where this has happened, we dug through Instagram page, something, and found a tweet where now we can name call and she is not deserving of us going out and protesting. We're not even going to mention her name ever again. If you can think of, did this, I don't think this happened with Sandra Bland. I don't think so. Maybe I'm wrong. I could be, you know, in error. If you can think of one time, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Anywho, if you could take about 5 minutes to share thoughts, observations that you have for the broadcast, that would be grand. Make sure everyone has another opportunity to speak, or at least one opportunity to speak. Once everyone has shared at least once, if you have additional questions, thoughts, feel free to jump back in, share any additional commentary. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps so that we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. If you can kind of get to a quieter area, maybe, and then you can share your commentary and then mute. And then again, same thing, if you need to share again, get back to the quiet spot, unmute, no problem. For this broadcast specifically, if we could not use metaphors, that would be super appreciated. The book that we are reading right now, Cased, is rife with metaphors, and they are not constructive. It is exactly what I say every weekend. Frequently, these metaphors contribute to a lot of confusion. They do not provide clarity in terms of what you are trying to communicate to your listeners or readers, whatever the audience happens to be. If we could strive for precision, exactness, race soldiers frequently, they will deliberately, skillfully utilize metaphors, comparisons to produce confusion. Deception. They'll take two concepts, right, two separate entities, and insist that they are identical, twins. Frequently, they are not the same at all. So again, if we could be mindful, no analogies, metaphors, similes, just be direct, specific with our commentary. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. let's see. The computer. Still do not have a brand new computer, still have not got my computer problem worked out yet, but we are close. The goal is, I think I was saying before, if I was going to get like a brand new computer, those are a little bit more expensive, or I could get like a refurbished 2015 MacBook Pro, which would be newer, significantly newer than the model that I have. Those 2015s are widely regarded as the last great MacBook Pro. I think I talked more in detail about it. I won't talk about it now, but they kind of changed up the machine quite a bit after that, and it seems to not be for the better. So the goal is just to replace both of the computers that I have now with 2015s. That way I should be stable and not have a problem, and I'll be back to where we were prior to both of my machines dying this summer, where I have my working computer and my backup, so we will not have any problems broadcasting moving forward. People have been super helpful. Like, it was kind of surprising, I think, in 2010, when I got said MacBook Pro, it took quite a while to get that MacBook Pro, and folks were Johnny on the spot in investing, or folks were immediate, prompt in supporting, and, you know, how close are we? Tell me, you know, what we need to get to the goal and all of that. So we are right there. I do need a new modem, though. So if folks would like to support, that is the top item on my wish list, new modem that has disrupted Wi-Fi services for Gusty a little bit. But that will pretty much finish out all of the assistance that I need to make sure the cows is stable and broadcasting without any problems. The computer death was a little jarring, not able to do the broadcast last weekend. I was quite upset, but I at least learned enough information. Cannot say that enough. Learn a little bit about everything. I was able to get enough information to resurrect my machines for a few days at least, and then I should be able to get the computers and be ready to roll quite shortly. So huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported, and just been right there to make sure we could get the broadcast back on. It was rough not being here last week. I know some folks have said for a long time the compensatory call-in is how they, you know, get some of their news for the week. So was a bummer not to be here last week, especially with the president getting the Rona and all. But we are back for this week, ready to roll, and line should be open. If you dialed in, have comments, thoughts to share, *61, line should be open. Proceed. If you want to invest, much obliged to all the folks who helped out. If you want to invest, support the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal is in the top right corner. Cash App is there as well. If you need more information, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, massive thanks to all the folks who supported. Man, I can't say it enough. I hope the cows has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. We could have been investing in toilet paper, hand sanitizer, tablets for at least some of us. Some of you all have offspring. Tablets for them to be doing school, like lots of other things. You know, gummy bears, anything. Vitamix, folks have been talking about that. Lots of other things that folks could have invested in other than the cows. So hopefully we will continue to be worthy of your time and energy. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Hello. Good evening. Okay. Hi. Salutations, everybody. It's Irene. I was calling to share something that happened yesterday, which will also lend to the moral of not stepping in with and for white people. But before I get into that, I have seen instances of non-white black female victims of racism who were ultimately victimized in the form of murder when they were in tragic arrangements. And I've seen people say things, you know, discounting their existence, or, you know, basically saying that it was okay that they were victimized that way because they were so-called swirlers. So it does happen to black women. It just doesn't happen with the pronouncement that it is with black men. So I agree with you. It's definitely Miss Andre. But right now, black people that are so-called conscious or woke or awake, they're expressing their disdain for both male and female participation in, you know, advocating or being, what do you call it, being assimilated into the dominant society. But the story that I wanted to say, I'll try to make it brief. I was in a well-to-do, affluent part of town that, of course, is basically white, exclusively white. And I was in my vehicle leaving the post office when a very old white female was getting out of her luxury vehicle with no assistance from family or friends. She was alone, and she went to get her walker out, and gravity pulled her backward, and she literally went flat on her back, and her head bounced off of the concrete. So I hate to say it, I'm a victim, and I'm still learning how not to want to help everybody. So I ran out of the vehicle, and I proceeded to try to lift her up. And as I did that, a non-white Mexican male stopped his work vehicle and got out with some paper towels so we could try to stop the bleeding. Well, of course, now that there are two non-white people surrounding this old white female, then everybody comes out. And I'm sure a lot of them saw her fall, but they we were the first ones to run over to help her. I did not realize that she was maintaining her position of racism until afterwards, and I will tell you how. So I'm holding the gauze or whatever to her head, and a white man comes out of an art gallery with a chair. He's like, here's a chair in case she wants to sit down. So I asked the lady, you know, we're holding her, and she was still on the ground. We're like, let us help you sit up. Let us help you get you in the chair. She's like, no, just leave me here. And I thought maybe she was in pain or something. So I was like, okay, it's a head injury. I ain't going to push it. But I noticed that nobody had called 911. So I was like, okay, I get it. I guess I'm going to have to call 911 and hold this paper to this lady's head. So that's when I called. And then fire rescue started trying to question me like I had done something. What's your name? What's your phone number? I'm thinking, like, my phone number should be obvious if I'm calling 911. So, you know, I gave the phone number for redundancy, and then he was like, what's your name and what's your address? I was like, sir, I have an older white lady here who's bleeding from the head at this address. Maybe you should just come here. And then he was like, well, can you at least ask her age for me? So I asked the age. I said, ma'am, how old are you? Because fire rescue needs to know. And she looked at me. Like, I asked for her routing number in her bank account, seriously. And she was like, it's okay. I'll be all right. I'll be all right. And so everybody came and responded, whatever. And when it clicked in after she said that, I was like, okay, all right, you good, you right, let me go. As soon as the paramedics came, I gave them the bandage and everything. And I said, wow, even after hitting your head on the concrete, you still think that I want something from you. You're that convinced. This is really wild. Of the first people to help you was a non-white black female and a Mexican. But it shows how victimized we are. We still subconsciously think in the back of our minds it's our duty to search and rescue or to aid and assist whenever they're in trouble. And I am making a point consciously not to help anybody classified as white. I don't care if it's CPR they need. I don't care if it's a Band-Aid. There are people that have the billets for that. I'm going to let them do that from here on out. And I am very sorry that victim lost his life trying to intervene. But unfortunately, I'm still learning, and I'm learning that we still see humanity in people that don't see it in us. And we have to take a different position and therefore act differently based in logic and according to the code. Thank you very much, everybody. Talk to you later. Have a good night, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Irie.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say to Irie really quick, I would have said, you know, that was Irie, but I had some audio issues right as I was clicking my mic over. But I know they are having the storm issues down in Louisiana, so great to hear from you. I know there's lots of concern for people in that area, hoping everyone is safe, hunkered down, and all the rest. Lots of hurricanes. We were just talking about that hurricane season and hoping that we can get through. The folks who live in that region can get through safe and sound. But good to hear from you. We did a program about that some years back. Don't help white people. One of the many, many controversial stances that we have taken over the years that upset many, many black people. We even talked about that in Cased. She has that scene, or she talks about that scene from Gone with the Wind, where the black character is fighting black Union soldiers to protect her white enslavers, right? And that is a part of the system in terms of how we have been brain trashed. So absolutely, thank you for sharing. We are all working as best we can to do better, not helping white people and not intervening. Like I said, that's one I would apply maybe across the board. If it's two white people fighting or five white, whatever it is, or non-white people fighting, not intervening for those public fisticuffs. That's all. Thank you, sir, for your patience. Proceed.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Can you hear me? Oh, okay. How you doing, Gus? This is Terrell from Detroit, Michigan. I hadn't been on in a few years. And it's pretty much the same up here as it always was. You know, we just up here, we're still struggling with, you know, just a lot of internalized racism.
I'm sorry. He's calling from, you said you're calling from Michigan. Is that right, sir? Mr. Terrell?
Detroit, yeah.
Yes, sir. It's Detroit. Not how it always was. They tried to kidnap your governor this week. Have they been trying to do that the whole time you've been in Detroit?
You know, it's strange. It's not really, when you're in Detroit, it's almost like you're in a different state. It's like the rest of Michigan, and it is Detroit. If you ask an average person on the street whether that was even a deep, serious issue, they would treat it like it was some kind of conspiracy thing. And it wouldn't be, or they would treat it like it was some kind of, like it was a prank or something. They don't. It's just not that deep to the average person in the city proper. If you ask a black person particularly, they just wouldn't even, they would just look at you like we got our place full. You know, so. And so it's really interesting. Obviously there is a plot or was a plot, whatever. But the problem with this state is like once you get outside a city, outside of Detroit, which is a chocolate city, it's all White Aryan Nation, Ku Klux Klan, Wolverine group, you know, organizations abound. And like most, you know, white countries, states, whatever, they don't do anything about them. They just let them run wild until they really break bad. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we got to do something. And that's another thing that affects the way we look at this whole thing is that, you know, we know once you get outside of Detroit and you go up a few miles north to Howell, Michigan, that's like a headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan for the state. And if they haven't done anything about them by now, they're not going to. It's almost like what Dr. Wilson used to say about if you live in a white supremacy system, there needs to be more of an, you know, you need symbols that reflect it. And I think the problem with, you know, living in the state of Michigan is that it's there, we're in it, but whites don't want to deal with it, and black people are too busy going to work and going to church to deal with it. So it's like, you know, it's like a really serious pathology around that. It's a real deep pathology around it. Yeah. But I have to admit, I miss communicating with you all because I've been sick for a while and finally got my health back together. So this is good to be back.
Health is extremely important. Cannot be overstated. We had a number of, you know, clips talking about health within the reports. In fact, I posted since we went live, they had an article in the New York Times today, and they were talking about even having, you don't have to be obese per se, but just having a little bit of excess weight, more than what your a healthy body weight should be for you and your body frame, that might put you at greater risk for health problems, including the Rona. I just posted that. That was in the paper today, but I'm super elated to hear that you are doing better and back with us. That is an important point, what he started with, though, saying if you talk to just some regular black people, victims of white supremacy in the Detroit area, that this kidnapping plot wouldn't really even register in terms of being something that's that serious, because they have much greater immediate problems, which is generally what I hear from black people who live in the Michigan area. But, and we talked about that. That's in James Lowen's Sun Downtown. He said when the migration of black people happened northward to areas like Detroit, Lansing, Chicago, they didn't just let black people go willy-nilly all throughout the state of Michigan. It was very isolated spots. Once you go out of those spots, sundown town. But exactly what he said. White supremacists, Ku Klux Klan, Wolverine groups. Exactly. Once you step 10 feet outside of Detroit or wherever the limited cities you are allowed to be in. We talked about that repeatedly. James Lowen, reading more important than watching television. Much obliged, our caller in Michigan, Mr. Terrell. Other folks, if we missed you totally, number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Greetings, callers and listeners. And once again, Gus, thank you for the platform. Glad to hear things are going well with, you know, purchasing new equipment and making sure you stay up to date with your stuff. First off, the police dogs segment was reading White Dog was really a good eye-opening book, but also definitely the Slave Hounds. That actual piece that was done was important as well, but I still was surprised by the actual, it's catching me now, the fact that people were hurt to the point that limbs were taken off, permanent damage to their bodies and all sorts of levels that actually did surprise me, because it gave another wake-up call, because I live in a non-white area that is at the present time being gentrified. And along with gentrification, with white people coming in, means dogs. And they're all over, you know, very few small dogs, mainly big dogs. As my attempted partner would say, most of them have dogs to keep us away. And that's really the reason why they have them. They're not having those little small dogs, pit bulls and Rottweilers, things like that. Going on to the segment about the governor of Michigan, that didn't surprise me too much. I'm looking for the case now where, you know, the majority of the police force and other, you know, entities like the CIA and the FBI, when they don't stop these cases, that's what I'm, you know, really kind of on guard about, because I feel like that's only a matter of time before that happens very soon, because this case was bound to happen at one point. One thing that really only because I have so many people that are saying, you know, you need to vote. But I've always had a code, and I'd like to just give some credit. From one of the books that I read, it was Claude Brown's Man, Child, and the Promised Land. And there was some things that he said in that book. It was kind of like documenting his life moving up in the inner city. And he stated that he would stop going to church because people would go to church and there would be majority non-white females. They would bring in a politician along with the priest and everything, and the politician would make all these big noises and talk all these things that he's going to do. And when he was elected by the women in the community, the so-called community, nothing would change. And after reading that, it stayed with me, and I started observing and seeing that in my own area. And as I saw it in my own area, as I've gotten older, I've seen the same thing. I mean, till this day, I mean, here we are with all these police shootings and everything else that's going on, only seeing them because we now have video. But it brought a lot of attention to the fact that from what I'm seeing is that I think that even though we are, as black males, we are also confused, I think there's a little less confusion about going in to vote coming from a black male perspective. And I think that's one of the things I didn't like about that segment that wasn't really discussed as to why most black men chose not to vote. A real honest discussion on that, but that's another one. And Gus, I had one last thing. I want to know if I could get this in because it ties into workplace racism, really, but it's something I think is kind of it's a little bit important. I think if I have some time to share it.
Oh, let's hear it.
Basically, in my company, I joined a black professionals group. They invited me. I attended some of the meetings to hear some of the things that were said, some people that came in to speak that were non-white mainly. And then I got put on board with the whole entire unit as far as being a part of the board. They put me and another non-white female in charge of the event. And one of the first events that came up that I thought of that would have been constructive was a mental health event. Mental health in the era of quote unquote COVID and for non-white people and people alike. The idea was well received. The head of the chairman of the Black Professionals Group took it and said, yes, that's a great idea. Let's do it, blah, 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 all this and that. I went ahead. I got a Howard University professor to come in and speak about it. And she was very excited and adamant to come to our company and speak about it. The company is an international company, so it's pretty big, and it's a big move for them. That being said, as we started to solidify dates and started to solidify pay, the chairman of the board came back to me, who is a non-white female, and stated, oh, yes, we're not going to be able to do it at this time due to issues that we're having getting all the paperwork done. We don't have any legal documents set up, and we don't know what we're going to be able to pay her. All these things all of a sudden started to come up as barriers. And then I was announced that it was good. Then and an email went out literally the same day stating that the company is now having a mental health month. And this month is mental health, and you guys will get Friday off, and you'll get to take that day off as your mental health day. In the middle of this COVID, it's very important that we stay stable and all these other jargon terms. And right afterwards, getting off the phone, I spoke to the non-white female that helps me with the events, and she was completely inflamed. She was so upset, and I agreed with her. She said they took your idea about mental health, brought it to their managers, who are all white, and pitched it to them as if it was their own. Now the whole concept of it being a black event is now out the window. And now it's just a regular mental health day instead of us actually having something for, quote unquote, the black professionals at the company. I bring this up because the majority of the group members are non-white females, and they took the idea and went to the white people in the office that have more power and broadcasted it to them. And then the non-white females are also a part of a Women and Allies group that then took the idea and said, oh, yeah, we're going to have an event at the exact same day. So it kind of infuriated me as well, but I realized that now I have to step back and save my ideas and save my thoughts, because while it was a good attempt, again, it's white supremacy, it's their structure, their system, and I have to understand that they're not going to produce anything on any level to be helpful to non-white people. That being said, I'll mute my line.
Workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Central, every Friday. That's the sort of thing that we discuss, and I mean, that's kind of like a double whammy there. That's a metaphor, but I mean, not only, and this is classic, they wait. So, oh, yeah, we're going to do the event of the Great Black Mental Health. Awesome. Great, great, great. Then, wait a minute. Can't get the, human resources, we can't get the paperwork through. Our legal team is behind. You know, the Rona slowed down everything. And, oh, and we don't have enough funding. We might not be, maybe if we can table this for Negro History Month, maybe, for 2022, maybe. We'll see if we can do it then. And then, whammo, they come back. We're going to make the whole month mental health. Now we got funds to take a day off and everything else. Certainly we're not having any Negroes from Howard come in and give some Negro talk about it. Squash your idea, steal it, make it their own. I think we've heard that like 5 or 20 times on workplace racism. Great effort, and at minimum, not being so, that's part of mental health, in my opinion. When you are not surprised when that type of thing happens in the workplace and not fuming and now your blood pressure's all up, like, we are in a system of white supremacy. It's not like this was my project. It's not even my desk. They can toss me out of here in the next 5 seconds. So, you know, enjoy my day off quietly. Much obliged for sharing, good sir. We have been talking about mental health a lot on workplace racism. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Hi. Greetings, Justin. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. The earlier segment about the NBA ratings, like I admitted before, I do admit, BGQ, I have been watching the NBA, and they were talking about the ratings. And because of the Black Lives Matter messages and commercials, and I, you know, it is, they do play it ad nauseum. I'm kind of, you know, I do get a little, you know, tired of the pandering. You know, that they want to end racism and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the one thing I always say is you want to start ending racism, just end racism in your own league first before you start talking about ending racism, you know, across the planet or the globe. But I think the ratings drop happened before the pandemic. If you could remember, there was an incident in Hong Kong. Well, it was an incident where a Rockets owner had talked about freeing Hong Kong from China, and basically China removed the NBA television from the country. Now, it's interesting to say that that was the point where the ratings had dropped in the beginning of the season, because if you look at it from a global perspective, behind soccer, basketball is one of the most watched sports around the world. And when you know, China, which is over a billion people, stop watching, then, you know, that's basically half of the NBA viewership there. So the ratings drop happened before the lockdown and the Black Lives Matter, you know, all that stuff within the NBA. Chicago and the Chase Bank promise of lending out, I think, 8,000 loans to Black and Latino, you know, homeowners. But, you know, the one thing is that the average price of a house in Chicago is like about 300, $300,000, and the average income for black people is like $30,000. So you do the math. Will any black people in Chicago be able to afford homes in Chicago? But, you know. The plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, the investigation found that, you know, this organization had guns, weapons, and explosives. Now, you know, just recently, the federal government sent federal agents to quell the violence by going after, you know, illegal weapons that filters into Chicago and Baltimore and all these other cities that they send federal agents to. I wonder if federal agents was also sent to Michigan to investigate this group. I mean, this group had explosives. Like, how do you get explosives? But, you know, that's a question I've been asking myself. But, you know, all of the mugshots that I saw on TV, they were all white people. So I guess I'm not surprised. But that's all I have on me in my life.
Michigan. Now, this is not a situation of the snowflake calling the milk white, changing the metaphor, you see. This is not that, because the Pacific Northwest, where I am, states like Washington State, Idaho, Montana, that this region, Oregon, is considered like an area with a high number of the militia groups, so-called white nationalists, white supremacists. It's a lot in this area, but also Michigan as well. If folks recall, Timothy McVeigh, and I think it's Terry Nichols, is in the Michigan area. He's in one of Michael Moore's documentaries. But that area also, I think, has the caller in Detroit talked about it. They have strong roots. So, yeah, lots of when we read Packing Them In Chicago, and they talked about all the bombings in Chicago to make sure that the Negros stayed in their place, didn't move out to those homes that are now $300,000. Bombings, bombings, bombings. Michigan is right next door. So, yeah, long tradition of, what is that, the Midwest white explosives makers in the Pacific Northwest. Matter of fact, Ted Kaczynski, he is from Chicago. He grew up right there. Like, I know he moved out to this area, this region, when he started doing his bombing and stuff, but yeah, he's a Chicago native too. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we missed you totally and you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. With the victim of racism that mentioned the coming up with the ideas, I definitely can resonate with that, workplace racism. And to get on to the felons being able to register to vote down here, Gus, there are some reports on that, you know, because I'm at the courthouse, so whites definitely are, you know, upset about that, at least coming from the other courthouse, from the reports that I'm getting. So it's very interesting. I have reports on that, on the next workplace racism. And I thought that was interesting how, I don't know how much money that was. I guess they said Bloomberg was trying to donate. I don't know if they said 20 million, a billion. I'm not entirely sure. And the attorney general wanted the FBI, I think, to investigate that. The white supremacists definitely stay working, staying focused on doing everything they can to strengthen the system. And I mentioned how they are using that term, either is fear, afraid, or scared, you know, some kind of synonym for being afraid. I think the president said, don't let this dominate you. Don't be afraid. I think about how they use that word in this context to give them strength and saying that, hey, you know, we're better than you. We're white anyway. So y'all want to stay home and be afraid. Y'all go ahead and do that. Then with incidents where when they kill black people, they say I was in fear, right? So they'll use that. They'll use one word, and I think it's other examples. But that seems to be a word they're very comfortable with using in, like, dual ways or something, like two ways. And that segment where they were talking about the voting, I thought that was like a sexual double entendre there where they say, get your booty to the polls. You know, like, it was some, I think that would have been a Welser moment, too. How they refer to a phallus as a pole. So, you know, I thought about that. And my last one is the white person was saying that about the COVID, that how, you know, he was thinking that it was overblown or something like that. And since he was saying that, you know, how you mentioned about the being obese or being overweight, saying, well, if I do get it, I'm more than likely not to be affected or something. But this virus has been fatally affecting multiple people, like all kinds of people. I think you played a report where it was a lady who was fit. I think she was exercising, and I think she's having chronic breathing issues. I think that's what it had on that report, if you remember, Gus. But other than that, those are all of the comments I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I remembered you had said something about that before. I thought it was workplace racism related, like some of the folks on the, maybe CLIC members who were making gripes or complaints about some of the felons who were trying to come in and, I guess, get their paperwork or whatever they might need so that they can go ahead and register and vote and be involved in the process again and making it known that they did not support this. Like I said, I think Ron DeSantis, now governor of Florida, I think when they were campaigning on all of this, I think he had said then, like, this is crazy just to let all these rapists and looters go back out and get all their voting rights in the Sunshine State. Like, this is lunacy. Have Andrew Gillum and the like try and push this over on us. Four more years. They said that that's another state that they say is important for the Electoral College, Florida. Yes. With the voting component and the stripper poll thing, now, they said in that segment, now, if you see something as being incorrect about all this, the problem is deep within you. That's what they said. They said, what would you think if LeBron James came out? Like, they stopped the finals tomorrow, and wait a minute, let's hear from LeBron. He had his, you know, jersey on and everything, and hey, folks, at least the folks in the States, everywhere else, you know, whatever, but folks in the States, hey, voting is important. If you want to be a champion, you get out and vote. Now, would you think there's something wrong with that? Maybe. I know when they got Michael Jordan to participate in the 2000 presidential election, GW, I did think there was something incorrect about that because he had said for so long, I'm not political. That's what he said in the Last Dance documentary and all that. But he did hop in to campaign for Bill Bradley at the time when he was running for president because he was teammates and friends with Phil Jackson. I did think there was something incorrect about that. You don't normally talk about politics. Why are you hopping in to talk about politics now? Phil Jackson asked you to do this? So if LeBron James had hopped in and asked me to vote, if he did this like at the game tomorrow, what have you, I might think something is, you know, a little bit odd, especially if they put like rap music to it and he's dunking and taking his jersey off and things. Yes, I would think something is a little suspicious about that, too. If this is how you're going to pitch to black people, black males specifically, the metaphors, that's why I say to watch the comparisons. Even with all of that, no. I do not think that is the same having strippers, black female strippers, We sit down. How are we going to appeal to black males? No one ever talks to them. What are black males interested in? Strippers. Yes. The problem is with me, because I think there could be something incorrect about that. Yes, that makes logical sense. Phallic symbol, polls, indeed. Other folks that we missed, if you have commentary, anybody that we have not heard from at all, have a hand up. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? Caller from New Jersey. Even with the, we talk about correct information, and in that clip it says, if I got it correct, it said, if you want to be on the jury, you have to register to vote. In the same breath, they were talking about felons getting their right to vote. If you are a felon, that's automatically going to disqualify you to be on the jury. I know that's the case in New Jersey. So, you know, let's be like you always suggest, let's be accurate. You know what I mean? Let's be accurate with the information. So in the state of New Jersey, you can vote even if you're a felon, but you will definitely be automatically disqualified to sit on any New Jersey jury. So, you know, so just because you are registered to vote in some cases, if you are a felon, you won't be able to sit on a jury. They were saying how voting is they were saying that they don't care how you vote. Voting is bipartisan, if I got that correct. And I guess bipartisan meaning that, you know, they're not really choosing a particular party. But I suspect those strippers encouraging black males to vote, if those black males were allowed to vote, you know, if a large number of black males would register to vote and all of them said, hey, you know, 4 more years, we're voting for Trump, I guarantee that will be a problem, and we'll get more reports of how black males are responsible for the reelection of President Donald Trump. So I will suspect that this pitch to get black males to vote is to get black males to vote, but to vote Democrat. I could be incorrect, but that's, you know, that's kind of like the conclusion that I'm coming to, because I find it very strange. It's like, you know, whether it's vote or die, all these ploys to get black people to vote, it seems that they're encouraging black people to vote and vote Democrat. You know, I could be incorrect. I could be crazy. You know, you know, I don't know. The gentleman who was killed in Texas, and there's been a, you know, there's been a real hoopla. I mean, there's a number of YouTube influencers. There's a number of people who are quote unquote, you know, for black justice and black equality, spokespeople for black people that's pulling their support away from this particular guy. I do find issue with people who are white supremacist deniers. But me personally, my, you know, I'm just like, you know, if I had a voice, I really wouldn't basically promote pulling support away from any black person who was killed by the police. I will probably keep my personal thoughts about his views on white supremacy separate. I think that, you know, if you do have a voice, we have to be very responsible because, you know, once upon a time, you know, I may have said some incorrect things because, you know, we are still learning. Matter of fact, I have said some incorrect things that if, you know, if something was to happen to me today and they, you know, they, hey, call it from New Jersey, you know, you said this. You know, now I'm pulling my support away. You know, the Negro should have just died. You know, it could be said about me, you know, and we are living in a system of white supremacy. So to have black people that's confused, that may seem to be in favor of the system over the system of white supremacy, and they may choose that over, they may choose living a comfortable life around white people over championing the cause of black people, that's going to happen. You know, I've come to the conclusion that we're in a system of white supremacy, so we are going to have anti-black white people. We are going to have anti-black black people. That's, I just think that's, you know, definitely all part of the system. So, I'm just learning to have a little bit more tolerance. And again, in this system, we really have no power. Now, if black people had the power where we could punish the quote-unquote traitors, then, hey, you know, I'm with it. You know what I'm saying? If we can legally, you know, jail them, bar them for work, or, you know, this was really like a military setting where, you know, they're giving up locations and we got a master plan and we're about to march on Washington and them no good Negroes, those what they call them coons, and they told the authorities about our locations and we could legally jail or execute right on. But we don't have that power, you know, so, you know, it really kind of like makes no sense. And I just see that these people who have influence, they spend more time outing the quote unquote sellouts than actually solving a problem of white racists that we're dealing. I mean, the problem of dealing with white racist people, it seems like it's more of back and forth between black people. So I just being though that we're in this system, I just really don't see that as a viable or a wise solution, you know. So yeah, so I'll yield with that. All right.
Much obliged, victim in New Jersey. I don't think, well, number one, I am elated, exponentially grateful that we do not have the ability to lock and jail traitors, coons, sellouts. I fear that the cows would not be in existence. Gus T would be jailed. Coon number one, or definitely in the top 20. I don't know whom gets to decide, like, this is the criterion for being a coon, if it's anything other than anyone who is subject to the system of white supremacy, racism, at any time in any area of people activity. If the definition of a coon or sellout is anything other than what I just said, I have no idea how they came up with the criterion, and I'm afraid I'm probably going to qualify. But I think the only accurate logical definition is what I just said. If that's the case, well then, hey, everybody on this line right now would be guilty and hopefully in the same position. Thankful that we are not going to be punished and hoping that that day does not come. Let's just stay focused on the problem. The folks who are responsible for all these coons and sellouts to begin with, racist man, racist woman, racist child. You get rid of the system of white supremacy, no more coons, no more sellouts, no name calling. other folks that we missed totally. We have...
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. The gentleman, I don't remember his name, who was shot and posted he loved white women. I've seen the vitriol behind it. But George Floyd had a white woman. People marched around and protested like he wasn't in a tragic relationship. And even Rayshard Brooks, the man in Atlanta who was killed in the Wendy's parking lot, his white girlfriend led the protest and was charged with the arson of the Wendy's. And but this guy's different. You know, it's no consistency. Either way, NBA ratings are down on TV, but they're up in internet traffic, social media, and YouTube clicks are also in their video game. So the TV is really the only place where they're down. But I think what they're doing is the future of sports. You know, right now is virtual fans and having these players in a controlled environment under 24-hour surveillance. Pretty soon they're just going to make it a reality show. But the social justice messaging doesn't explain why every sport is down. I have to see if that was just the NBA. To me, what all these sports have in common is we're still in a shutdown. Millions of people are unemployed who had a job, you know, at the beginning of these seasons last year. And right now, I think what's killing the ratings is the bars and restaurants are closed. The stadiums are empty, no tailgating. And most importantly, is gambling. Gambling is down. Vegas is still empty. And that's the number one thing that drives all sports in America is gambling. The Chase Bank story, 20 years ago when I moved to Harlem, there were more abandoned buildings than there was there was more abandoned buildings and buildings in the process of being restored than there were actually occupied buildings. And today, there are no vacant buildings 20 years later. All the buildings are fully occupied and they're building on vacant land and things are like that. But when you walked around back then, as they were restoring these abandoned buildings and they put the signs out in front of them, you found out that the owners were Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch. You know, they owned all these buildings in Harlem and just let it deteriorate for years until the market was peak for them. And a lot of what you're seeing with these investments, so-called investments into so-called black communities, is coming from this empowerment zone and these loans and things coming from these empowerment zones that Trump created, but those are actually going to, in the long term, gentrify those areas, just like when Clinton did the 1031, same thing, just Trump's is a little bit more larger. The attempted kidnapping of the governor in Michigan, a group of Michigan militiamen members decided to kidnap the governor, blow up her home, put her on trial for treason, then kill her. These guys have videotapes. They had a confidential informant ended with these guys since July 4th. They've been planning this. And they were making bombs out of fireworks and tying pennies and barons and stuff around them. So when they explode, it intensifies the bomb. They even went as far as to test some of these bombs out with the confidential informant. These guys were not the brightest people. However, they performed surveillance on this lady's house up to four or five times. This shows you how dedicated white people are. They wanted to put her on trial for making them wear masks and not letting them go work out. You know, it's like, are you serious? But the danger in this is Michigan, one of the five states that has over 700,000 hunting licenses. And Michigan and the United Kingdom are the same exact size in area. But United Kingdom has 148,000 soldiers. So they have more people with hunting licenses than soldiers. You know, that just shows you how large, you know, anything that goes off. The juxtaposed to this, and on Gus back in Seattle, where y'all had the Chop and Chaz on, what I found out this week, that all of the people that were killed, all four victims, were black inside of this Chop Chaz zone. And I'm like, what's the chances? It's hardly any black people. For 100% of the victims to be black, I mean, that amazed me. Lastly, and this is as per the debate, six of the nine Supreme Court justices are conservatives, so-called conservative white supremacists. And then you got, well, I guess, you know, Clarence Thomas and the other five. Two were put there by Bush 1, one by Bush 2, and two by Trump. It looks like he's going to get the third one. So that's six. So during the debate, they asked both Biden and Kamala Harris if they would pack the court, meaning they would raise the amount of judges to 12 so they could even it off if they become president. And neither one of them said no. In fact, they diverted that question very slickly. And that just shows how white people think, you know, if they can't win, they're going to change the rules. You know, they're not going to lose just off of merit. You know, it's, you know, we're going to go in there and add three more justices, and now we'll have 6-6. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
If you can't win, change the rules. That's how you get down. Can't win, at least cheat. At least cheat. Is there anybody that we missed, like, completely? The white folks, well, white people, period, are dangerous. But, man, white people, and that's it. Terry Nichols, he was one of the homies of Timothy McVeigh. I think he's in Michigan. I think he and his brother, they were into all of that stuff. They are amongst that number, hunting licenses, and bragged about their merits with rifles and firearms, explosives. Like, I think I got his name correct. The male caller who just spoke up. Yes, sir.
My apologies. This is Mo from Dallas.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Des. Greetings to listeners and callers. The group that plotted to kidnap and put the governor of Michigan on trial, this reminded me of a group called the Hutari. Back in 2010, Hutari is spelled Hutaree, and it is defined as a Christian warrior. This is a Christian white militia group. But they were caught plotting to murder a cop so that they could ambush the funeral and to murder more cops and then set rally points with tripwires so that they could murder more cops. I mentioned that group in relation to this white supremacist militia group in Michigan just to say that they found the Hutari. They were indicted, but they were not charged at the end of it all. I thought it was interesting that this militia group, the most current one of Michigan, the informant was one of the ones that was inciting most of these or a fair amount of these conversations, you know, as far as plotting and promoting the production of these homemade explosive devices, and they were establishing a proper timeline to execute so that they could impact the election. As far as the in relation to the security guard who got bitten by the white woman. The female caller earlier who was helping a white woman and the victim that had passed, Jonathan Price. It is difficult to kind of restrain yourself just because of your humanity. I know this from having friends that do security, that perform security, professionals in security. But the job of a security guard is to only observe, report, and notify the authorities. So anything, any damage that happens to your person is kind of at your own expense. So I would advise victims to think about that moving forward. As far as get your booty to the polls, I was aware of this when it when this video came out or was released. I found it interesting because it was one of the first few times that I saw the actual two words black male being mentioned in a political forum. To be informed that if I had an issue with these strippers promoting voting, then I'm the problem. When LeBron James was promoting social justice, I believe he was told to shut up and dribble. You know, so I find it very interesting that they would promote that black males take political advice from exotic dancers. Thank you. That's all I have. I'm in my line.
Much obliged. I do remember that. Shut up and dribble. Since I did mention Timothy McVeigh, it was Terry Nichols. His brother is James Nichols, both in Michigan. His brother died, but they are both connected to Timothy McVeigh, the convicted Oklahoma City bomber. As I was checking to get that information of these fellas, Michigan homies, the report, Michigan militia group had ties to Timothy McVeigh. Members of a Michigan militia group are accused in a plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and that militia has ties to the darkest day in Oklahoma City's history. That Michigan militia group is called the Wolverine Watchmen, mentioned before our caller in Detroit. It's the same group that had ties to Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. 13 men, including members of the Wolverine Watchmen, are accused of trying to kidnap Michigan Governor Whitmer and storm the state capitol, igniting what they reportedly believed would be a civil war. Timothy McVeigh met with the Wolverine Watchmen before the Oklahoma City bombing, although it's unclear what kind of relationship they had. Mike Bocher of the OU Center for Intelligence and National Security specializes in radicalized militia groups. I'll stop there. I'll see if we can get him on the program. But I am not surprised. Michigan, I get the same thing like when we were reading about Chicago. I don't think people would think, wow, they bombed and killed a lot of black people in Chicago. But that is true. Michigan, what they call it, a hotbed of white supremacy and violence, terrorism. That is true. Let's see. I guess we're about done. But our caller in Michigan, did you have a comment you wanted to get in before we get ready to wrap up?
Yes.
We can hear you.
Oh, yes. I got one last statement. As for with regards to the stripper pole thing, the real reason that Donald Trump is in office is it has to do with the black people. It has to do with white women. They're the majority of the majority of the people in this country, and they were the ones that put Trump over, not black people. I knew that man was going to get elected when I saw all of them bunching up over whether or not they were going to when they were arguing over that they didn't like Hillary Clinton. When I went to the polls to vote in 2016, there were no white women there. All I saw at the polls, and I'm in a chocolate city, was pickup trucks and overhaul jumpers and work boots. And white men voting. Them white women that work in them strip clubs and stuff, they don't vote either. And they're the reasons. And see, Trump, they complain about him all of the time, but he has the same personality orientation And most of those white women's fathers, uncles, brothers, cousins, militia people have. And they trust that as leadership. They just get on TV and complain about them like a dog, but that's who they vote for. They just get in, they just get in front of our faces and lie. Even Bill Maher exposed the fact that black women put Trump over on his show. So it was a couple of years ago when he did it, but, you know, those are the people that need to be targeted to tell them to go vote and to vote Democrat, not black men or black people. We don't have enough population to put anyone in or take them out. Voting wise, it's Miss Ann who's the problem there. Hello?
4 more years. Yes, sir. Heard all of crystal clear. 4 more years. If we're going to wait on the white woman to take up our cause at the ballot box or anywhere else, frankly, oof, we will be waiting a very, very long time. Hillary Clinton, my gosh.
Indeed.
I don't think we missed anyone. I don't see any empty hands. We got everybody. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Do we miss anyone?
Can I say one more thing, though?
I reckon.
To the female caller, that first caller, I want her to look up, type in into YouTube, Allen Iverson, Tyronn Lue. And what Allen Iverson did is what you do next time a white person passes out in front of you. Just step right over them and keep walking. I mean, my mom goes.
No helping white people. Allen Iverson said he hates seeing that moment. That's one of his more regrettable moments of his career. I was stunned. He said he loves Tyronn Lue. No disrespect. But yeah, white person. No helping white people. No, I know that's a tough one. We did a pro, like I said, we've got backlash. I have got backlash for many, many things over the years. That is one that stands out specifically. Miss Zanelle dialed in from the UK was the first one to spearhead the effort. No helping white people. That is not taking us closer to a solution. We have been trained and conditioned for centuries. Helping out white people. Oh, let me get you that. Oh, let me get it. That's the movie. They don't even give us Academy Awards. And The Help did get an Academy Award. That's part of the conditioning to help maintain the system. We talked about it so many times with Dr. Kevorkian. It's in so many films where that'll be a central component. Helping white people. Very important to be mindful of that, and all of us, you know, working on it to the best that we can. Not helping our enemy, racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, we will wrap things up. Much obliged. Glad to be back. Felt like we were gone for a long time, but it was really only like one program that we missed. But back rolling. I was fearful right after I had my computer problem, so I didn't want to schedule any programs. But now it seems like things are corrected and we'll be able to get my computers replaced shortly. So I guess I'll get back to work scheduling programs. Did not have anything scheduled for the next couple of days, but we will be here for the book club. Now that I'm feeling better about my computers, if that changes, just check the Facebook group, Black Talk Radio Network, Twitter as well, facebook.com/thepropblemiswhitepeople. That is my Facebook page. It's public. You can see all the programs. I post the events there. Black Talk Radio Network as well. Twitter @UntilJustice to get all the updates info. We got a massive update from my young scholar who is going to school, an apartment with two white males. That'll be in Workplace Racism this coming Friday. We'll give the update on his situation and see if we can give him any additional tips. He was very thankful, very, very thankful. He listened to the program and just said he was super grateful for all of the input, and he made a nice little list of what he can incorporate to try to stay safe moving forward. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Man, lots of reasons. We need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency. You got white people with explosives and everything. We need to be thinking, alert about what's happening around us. Man, especially if you're going out. With sober, I would recommend hunkering down for lots of reasons. We got the Wolverine militia group, Timothy McVeigh's ilk out and about, regular armed, lots of armed white people. You heard the data. Many reasons. The Rona, the president is infectious and going out with no mask. It's lots of reasons to hunker down for the time being. If you gotta go out, is something serious, you know, whatever it is, essential work, doing something for your offspring, whatever. We're sober, one, but you are alert. When you go out, you are checking around, scan your surroundings. If it looks like a white person is being loud, man, we are not breaking up fights. It's VGQ. If you want to go out and do that, I think that should just be a part of the code. We are not breaking up fights. We heard that from several of our listeners who've seen that where it went kind of wrong. Observe, note, report. That is what to do. You want to stay at a safe distance. They had a black female security guard. That was just this week. That white woman bit her finger, drew blood. I don't know if she had to get stitches or whatnot, but I mean, who was trying to go through all that just to break up a fight between some strangers? Keep all of that in mind. If it looks like this could be something that gets hostile, out of here. No risks in 2020. Get to a safe location immediately. And I think that perspective, shared with people you care about, particularly your offspring. Sober, buckled. If you're going out, you're buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Number one, we need all of our attention, paying attention to what's happening around us. Two, minimize contact with enforcement officers, badge or no. Just trying to do the meager things that we can to stay safe in a system of white terrorism. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.